The worst of it, Fortunato thought, was having to listen to the goddamn politicians. There were a dozen of them on stage, including Mayor Koch and Senator Hartman. Tachyon, the bastard, was already gone, cozied up to a gorgeous black woman with plaited hair. Hartman was at the podium. "The time has come for acceptance, a time for peace, as the biblical poet said. Not only for peace between nations, but peace within ourselves. A time to look into our own hearts, human and joker and ace alike. A time not to forget the past, but to be able to look back at it and say, this is where I have been, and I am not ashamed. But my duty now is to the future. Thank you very much." A police helicopter circled overhead. As Fortunato glanced up, he saw the turtle's shell float slowly over the park and then pass out of sight again. Fortunato knew roughly where the kid was. This close to him, he could get a vague image of what the kid saw, and he could triangulate off Hartman as he sat down at the edge of the stage. There, 15 or 20 yards away, wearing clothes for once, which meant he'd come in his human form and stayed that way. The kid slouched against a light pole, a good 15 or 20 feet away from an older version of himself, clearly his father. The kid looked around at all the suits and high heels as they offered Hartman dignified, minimal applause. One side of his mouth turned up in disgust. Fortunato knew how the kid felt. Maybe once there'd been some sincere feeling in these ceremonies, but now it was a case of the bored leading the boring. Nobody came to self-serving political speeches, except the people who needed to be seen there, the ones making some kind of political statement themselves by showing up. And those few who really did care, the star-struck kids who still had some illusions about personal power, who still believed in that sharp, clean line between good and evil, and wanted to wage war across it. Fortunato saw the wild card as a kind of Aladdin's lamp of the unconscious. The virus rewrote DNA to match what it read in the back of the mind. If your luck was bad, it transcribed a nightmare, and if you lived through it, you were a joker. But sometimes it hit a vein of the pure stuff, like Arnie's love for dinosaurs and comic books and aces. And even though it made a bit of a joke out of him, it let him live his dreams out on the street. The joke was a law of nature, the conservation of mass. Arnie could turn into any dinosaur he could visualize, but his mass remained the same. If he was a tyrannosaur, he was a 3-foot-high tyrannosaur. Okay for a kid, but he was already 13 or 14, full of adolescent juice and delusions of immortality. "Hey," Fortunato shouted at him. "Hey, kid!" Arnie turned to look at him. The kid's arm came off. It flopped like the muscles had grown their own brain, and then it was sailing through the air and bouncing across the pavement. Fortunato and the kid both stood there for an instant, not comprehending. And then blood began to fountain out of the ragged flap of flesh, and the air smelled like a butcher shop. The kid started to change. Even with an arm gone, his instincts were good. His remaining arm shrank and grew scales. His thighs began to swell, and his stomach shrank. Fortunato reached out with his power and tried to stop time. The people around him slowed, but the blood pumped undiminished from the kid's arm socket. The astronomer, Fortunato thought, shielding the kid from the power that could save him. Fortunato tried to run toward him. It was like running in a nightmare, the air thick as wet cement, draining his strength. The kid was losing too much blood. It puddled around his tennis shoes, soaked the cuffs of his jeans. He couldn't finish the change. His left hand had grown a huge, scythe-shaped claw, and he slashed futilely in front of him with it. His face was still human, except for a bulging lower jaw. The eyes flashed from shock to rage to fear, and finally to helplessness. A handful of flesh came out of the kid's throat. The blood from his shoulder slowed as his neck began to spurt. The kid collapsed. His weirdly jointed legs and the beginnings of a long, stiff tail kept him from falling more than halfway. His chest opened, and his heart fell out onto the concrete. The heart seemed to shiver in the sunlight, fibrillating spasmodically for no more than a second before it lay still. And then there was a little man, maybe a couple of inches over 5 feet tall, standing next to the kid's distorted corpse. He had an ankle-length black robe that was soaked and spattered with blood. His head was too big for his body, and he wore thick glasses. Fortunato had seen him twice before. Once was inside an Egyptian Masonic temple in Jokertown 7 years before. Fortunato had been looking out through the eyes of a woman he loved, a woman named Eileen, who was now dead. The second time was when Fortunato had led the attack on the cloisters, which had led to the Howler being dead, and to this death, right here in front of him.
"I waited for you," the astronomer said. "I was beginning to think you wouldn't come, and I'd have to start without you."
His voice had an ugly sing-song rhythm. Fortunato couldn't get within 20 feet of him. "Why the kid? For Christ's sake, why the kid?"
"I wanted you to know," the astronomer said. "I'm not fucking around anymore."
He sniffed his blood-drenched fingers. "You're all going to die. Between now and 4 a.m. Be sure and set your watches." He glanced up at the podium, his eyes moving as if he was looking for somebody that wasn't there. He nodded to himself and smiled. 4 a.m., Fortunato was shouting. He leaned into the force field that straitjacketed him. "Why 4 a.m.? What happens then?" Then the field was gone, and he staggered forward, off balance. The astronomer was gone. Time sped up around him. He was unable to look away as the kid's father saw the mangled ruin of his son and began to scream.
Spectre emptied his beer mug and stifled a belch. The bottomless pit, located between 27th and 28th Streets, a half block west of Chelsea Park, was far enough off the beaten track to avoid a crush of tourists. The place had a reputation for violence that kept most of the locals away. There were only two other people sitting at the bar, although all the tables were occupied. The only light in the bar area came from the neon beer signs and the television. He heard billiard balls smacking together in the back room. "You want another?" the bartender asked. He was tall, with curly blonde hair and a bodybuilder's physique. "Sure." Spectre was a little lightheaded. His fingers and toes were getting numb. It was about time. He'd been drinking on and off all day. The astronomer was off his back, so he could lie low here, get drunk, and watch the game when it came on. That would just about fill the time until he had to go to the Haiphong Lily. The bartender drew a beer and set it down on the scratched, pitted wood. Someone had carved, "Joyce, plus whoever I say," into the surface. Spectre picked up the beer, enjoying the cold glass on his skin. As usual, the pain was chewing him up inside. Maybe, if everything went well tonight, he'd cap off the evening by killing some tourists. He'd never go to jail for it. That was the beauty of his power. The cops had hauled him in once, but the case had been thrown out in the preliminary hearing. There was never any physical evidence to prove he killed his victims. "And now for a special report from Channel 9 reporter Carl Thomas, live at Jet Boy's tomb." Spectre looked up at the television. The young black reporter paused, put a finger to his ear, and nodded. People standing in the crowd behind him leaned around and waved their arms, trying to get into the shot. "This is Carl Thomas reporting. Yet another story in what is already the most violent wild card day in 10 years. Apparently, a psychopathic ace killer is roaming the streets. His latest victim is a young boy who had the power to turn himself into a small dinosaur. There is no official word from the police indicating whether the boy's death is related to the earlier killing off the Howler. However, based on eyewitness accounts, this is the second such attack today by the same person. This morning in Jokertown, a man fitting the suspect's description assaulted what we hope was only his first such victim, twisting his head completely around. Luckily, Fortunato intervened and healed the victim with his ace powers. Sadly, he was unable to do anything to save the boy. This is Carl Thomas, Channel 9 News, at Jet Boy's tomb. Fuck. Spectre reached for his beer and knocked it over. Foam spread slowly over the bar. They have to come on the goddamn TV about that. Couldn't have kept their ugly mouth shut. That terrible tragedy. In an apparently unrelated incident, Federico Macholaio was killed in an automobile accident earlier this afternoon. Macholaio, also known as the Butcher, and reputed to be a major figure in the city's underworld, was dead at the scene. "It's just not my fucking day," Spectre muttered. He pulled out his wallet and motioned to the bartender, but the man was looking at the door. Spectre turned. There were three punks standing just inside the doorway. They all had black hair cut like Moe of the Three Stooges. The words "Bedtime Boys" were emblazoned in red on the backs of their leather jackets. Each carried a fiberglass skateboard. The leader, who was a head shorter than the other two, wore mirrored sunglasses. "Shake everybody down," said the little boss, blowing on his fingertips. Spectre's bar stool creaked loudly as he swiveled to face them. He was worried about the kid with shades. His power was no good unless his victim's eyes were visible. The other two he could handle. "Nice of you to get that out for us," said one of the stooges, eyeing Spectre's wallet. "Hand it over." Spectre shoved his wallet back into his pants pocket. "Fuck off, you little shit, while you still can." "Feed him his teeth, Billy," said the leader. "It'll save time with everybody else." Billy whipped the board around his body a couple of times, then swung it up into an attack position. It reminded Spectre of the Chinese bench fighters he'd seen in kung fu movies. These guys obviously knew what they were doing. He'd have to take them out in a hurry. He locked eyes with Billy. Spectre's death flowed into him. Billy fell face first into the bar rail. "Shit! Get him, Romeo!" The little punk was still directing traffic. Romeo looked at Billy's body, then at Spectre. Mistake. 5 seconds later, he was dead on the floor. Spectre sensed movement and raised his arm, reaching for the Ingram with his other hand. The skateboard slammed into his forearm, jolting him hard enough to knock him over and send the gun flying. He bounced off a table and landed on the floor. The gun was several feet away. The punk dropped his skateboard and grabbed the pistol. He centered it on Spectre's chest and smiled. A cue ball caught him in the side of the head as he pulled the trigger. Spectre rolled as the bullets tore up the table and floor. He felt bits of wood dig through his clothes and into his flesh. He crawled to the remaining Bedtime Boy. The kid sat up and shook his head. The sunglasses were gone. "Goodbye," Spectre said. The punk met his eyes and gasped, then keeled over. Spectre grabbed the Ingram and holstered it, then stood. The bartender was looking at him, afraid but annoyed. Nobody was talking. "Some people got no manners at all. These boys are doing the big sleep now. Serves 'em right," Spectre said, rubbing his arm. The bartender gestured tentatively toward the door. Don't worry, I'm gone.
Hey, tough guy, throw us back our cue ball.
A short, well-built man in a white tank top pointed at Spectre's feet. He picked up the ball and tossed it back. Nice shot. The bartender coughed. Spectre walked out into the sunlit street, reaching inside his shirt to tug the splinters out. The fight with the skateboard punks had momentarily made him forget about the astronomer. He sucked air in through his clenched teeth. With Butcher dead, the job was probably off. Couldn't hurt to find out, though. He pulled a quarter from his pants pocket. He found a payphone just down the street from the bottomless pit. There was no answer at the dime museum, so Spectre called the Twisted Dragon and asked for Danny Mao. After waiting for a few moments, a young Oriental came on the line. Danny Mao, who's this? The voice was smooth and assured, with only a trace of accent. My name's Spectre. I was born in the year of the Fire Horse. I need to get in touch with one of your people. Guy with a Boston accent. Sharp. Careful. There was a brief pause. Mr. Spectre, I'm not familiar with you. Who gave you my number? A joker named I. Look, I was contacted this morning about a job. Things have changed. I have to find out what he wants done. Can you help me or not? Possibly. But he's a very busy man, particularly today. Perhaps I can have him contact you later. Fine. I'll take the notebooks to someone else. He figured the lie would get Mao's attention.
Ah, I see. Where are you now?
Mao had bitten hard. The notebooks must be even more important than Spectre had originally guessed. You just give me the number, or I'll make sure the word goes around that you held up delivery on these babies.
Call 555-4301. It's his private line.
You'd better not be jerking us around. Spectre hung up on Mao in mid-sentence. A chic young couple was standing behind him, obviously waiting to use the phone. He stared at the woman, grabbed his crotch, and licked his lips. They hurried away. Spectre dropped another quarter into the slot and punched in the number. He answered on the first ring. Latham. It was the person who'd called that morning, no question. The only Latham he was aware of was a big cheese lawyer. This is Spectre. Have you heard about Butcher?
Of course. His death does alter a few things.
Latham didn't act surprised to hear from him. There was a sound of fingers on a keyboard. So everything's off, right?
Let me see. I think it would be best for you to have dinner at the Haifong Lily in any case. The Gambioni family is extremely vulnerable right now. I don't think they could stand to lose any more leadership. It could destroy the family entirely.
So you want as many senior members killed as possible, right? Spectre looked around to make sure no one was in hearing distance.
Yes, we might be able to work out a bonus situation for you based on how many you neutralize.
Fine. I said you'd set it up for me to get in with no trouble. Is that right?
I'm sure that's the case. By the way, who gave you my private number?
Smooth punk named Mao. Spectre hoped they gave the kid bamboo shoots under the fingernails.
I see. Thank you, Mr. Spectre. We'll be in touch. Good hunting.
Spectre hung up the phone. The quarter dropped into the change box. He looked up and down the street. If the astronomer got hold of him, there wouldn't be a bonus. There wouldn't even be a tomorrow.
Out on the street again, Jennifer took stock of her situation. She wasn't wearing much in the way of clothes. She had no shoes. She'd spent her last dime on the taxi that brought her back to Manhattan. What to do next? Before she could make up her mind, though, things were decided for her. They came out of nowhere. Two men emerged from the pedestrians milling around her, gripped either arm, and hustled her down the street. "Make a sound and you'll die," one whispered to her, and she swallowed the instinctive scream welling in her throat. They crossed the street and went into a small park across from the Dime Museum. There were three other men there, waiting. One of them was the reptilian joker she'd first seen in Kian's condominium. "The books," he hissed, coming close to Jennifer. "Where are they?" She flinched backward from the long forked tongue that lolled from his mouth. I don't have them on me. I can see that." He stared without blinking at her bikini-clad figure. "Where are they? If I told you, then you wouldn't need me." The reptilian joker grinned, dripping saliva from the overlong incisors that hung down from his upper jaw. He leaned forward, and his tongue flickered caressingly over Jennifer's face. She flinched backward at the warm, wet touch of it. The joker stooped, and his tongue slipped down the column of her throat, between her breasts, then up again and down her bare arms. It rasped sensuously on her forearm, and Jennifer shivered, half in fear, half in delight. The man gripping her right arm held it stiffly at the wrist, and the joker licked her palm before she could close it into a fist. The tongue lingered on her hand, then the joker straightened himself and pulled his tongue back into his mouth. "We don't need you anyway," he hissed. "You taste of the alien tachyon." His eyes narrowed. "Why did you give him the book?" The card hadn't lied, Jennifer thought. The suit had once belonged to Tachyon, and this joker had somehow gotten his scent off it. She couldn't deny his accusation, but she didn't want to tell him that she'd put the books in the statue either. She had to come up with a good story. But she wasn't a very good liar. Tell me. The joker's fingers had thick, sharp nails. He ran them across the bare skin of Jennifer's chest, not hard enough to draw blood, but hard enough to leave red welts with their passing. The tree behind them blew up, blew right up, showering them with leaves and fragments of branches. The shock waves from the explosion knocked Jennifer and the men holding her to the ground. One let go of her arm, and she kneed the other one three times. She wasn't sure if she hit his stomach or groin, but whatever she hit was tender enough to make him scream and let her go. She rolled away and looked wildly around, as the thugs were doing. "There!" one of them pointed across the street. A man stared back at them. His features were concealed by a hood. He was of average height, rather nicely built. Nothing about him really stood out, though, except for the bow he held. It was a high-tech piece of machinery with funny curves and multiple strings and what looked like small pulleys attached to it. He was calmly knocking another arrow while people on his side of the street also noticed him and started to run about like a flock of panicked chickens. The reptiloid seemed to recognize him. He hissed hatefully as the man brought his bow to bear, but a bus going down the street suddenly blocked his aim. The thugs were scattering, and Jennifer took this as a propitious time to do some vanishing of her own. She ran deeper into the park, thanking her lucky stars for the man's intervention. How did he fit into this? She wondered. What could he want? She wondered if he was the crazed bow and arrow vigilante that the papers had been full of the last few months. He must be. New York City was a strange place, but she doubted that there could be two people running around shooting at things with a bow and arrow. And she realized something else as she cut through a copse of trees, wincing as she stepped on a sharp stone. She had seen him before. Even though he now wore a hood, she recognized him by his clothes and by his build as the man who had accosted her in the bleachers of Ebbets Field. Why was he following her? What did he want?
Chapter 9, 2 p.m. It was 2 o'clock before Bagabond was able to return to Rosemary's office. Both the streets and the subways were swollen by the masked and made-up revelers. Once she had seen an alligator snout in the crowd, but Even as she turned towards it, she realized it was papier-mâché, not Jack. It had deeply disturbed her. Vagabond had always felt self-pity at the changes in her life caused by the virus. Jack and his often uncontrollable shape-shifting taught her that there were worse fates than experiencing the deaths, births, and pain of every wild creature in the city. She leaned against the wall and considered the horrible fates of the Jokers, never able to escape into hiding because of deformities too hideous or life-threatening to be hidden, trapped in the isolation of their own betraying bodies. Vagabond shivered violently, closed her eyes for a moment, and reached out to the Black and the Calico, her oldest companions. They were safe. The thought warmed her. A slight tug alerted her. She reached down for her camouflage fabric purse as she sent a wave of hate and threat at the man attempting to snatch her handbag. Startled at her reaction and disoriented by the alien feeling in his head, the tentacled Joker-masked purse snatcher retreated into the crowd. She rarely attempted to use her ability on humans. She was never sure what its effect, if any, would be. Still uncomfortable in her heels, Vagabond pushed off from the wall and entered the surging flow of the crowd as it, and she, moved towards Jetboy's tomb and the Justice Center. By the time she reached the Justice Center, much of the crowd had diverted into Jokertown, Jetboy's tomb, or Chinatown. Vagabond walked into the district attorney's building. She felt less at home in the business suit costume than she did in rags, and it was more difficult to walk with head raised confidently. Getting out on Rosemary's floor, she realized that Paul Goldberg was no longer on phone duty. Vagabond nodded to the current receptionist and walked back toward Rosemary's office. As she did, Goldberg walked out of an adjacent office, arms filled with legal references, nearly colliding with Vagabond. "Christ, sorry." Goldberg attempted to juggle the books, succeeding with all but the top one, which Vagabond neatly caught. "Thanks," he said. "You okay?" "Fine. You were released from the phones, I take it." Vagabond carefully placed the book on top of the stack beneath Goldberg's chin. "You caught my act?" Goldberg grinned, then looked puzzled. "I can't believe I don't remember seeing you." "You were distracted." "Is Ms. Muldoon in?" Vagabond gestured toward Rosemary's office.
"If you thought this morning was distracting, you'll love this afternoon. All hell's broken loose."
He shifted the book slightly to the right.
"So, if you get a chance, say goodbye before you leave. You'll be a breath of sanity."
"We'll see."
She reached out and steadied the top volume.
"Goldberg, where are those goddamn casebooks?"
The rough, disembodied voice was distinctly impatient.
"Never keep Mrs. Chavez waiting."
He trapped the first book with his chin and began trotting down the hall.
"Later, I hope."
Vagabond turned to watch him leave. Looking back toward Rosemary's office, Vagabond saw her leaning against the doorframe, smiling.
"Making a conquest, Ms. Melotti?"
Rosemary waved Vagabond inside her office. Vagabond shook her head, realizing angrily that she was blushing.
"Uh-huh. Why the outfit?"
Rosemary closed the door behind her.
"Have a seat." "Business."
Vagabond sat down and kicked off her shoes with an inaudible sigh.
"Does that translate to, I really don't want to know?"
Rosemary received only a bland stare from Vagabond. She continued.
"The butcher's dead. Car accident. I can't say I'm tremendously distraught, but I'm not buying the accident theory. Know anything about it? Happened in Central Park a little after 12 noon.
Rosemary sat on the edge of her desk and leaned back, stretching her neck and arching her spine.
"As resident expert on the families, everybody's been asking me about it. I was hoping maybe a squirrel or one of the cats saw something." "Sorry, their memories are much too short for..."
Vagabond gasped and broke off.
"Jack!"
Her body spasmed.
"Suzanne? What's going on? Should I call a doctor?"
Rosemary grasped Vagabond's hand, only to have it jerked away.
Vagabond saw the end of her snout, a bright flash of flame. She saw a hand holding a packet of small books wrapped in clear plastic, another hand waving the pistol, another flash.
She still looked 16 to Fortunato, though she was obviously old enough to be serving drinks. She wore jeans, sneakers, and t-shirt under her apron, and her red-brown hair was pinned up in a loose mess on top of her head. She had a row of dishes lined up on one arm, and a fat tourist grabbing the other. The tourist was shouting at her about something, and she was starting to sweat. Her sweat was an event. Water began to condense out of the air all around her. The fat tourist looked up, trying to figure out how it could be raining inside. "Jane," Fortunato said quietly. She whirled around, eyes as wide as a gazelle's.
"You,"
she said, and the dishes hit the floor. "Relax," Fortunato said. "For God's sake." She pushed her hair off her forehead.
"You wouldn't believe the day I've had."
"Yes," Fortunato said. "I would. I want you to not ask any questions. Just come with me right now. Forget your purse or sweater or whatever." Obviously, she didn't like the idea. She looked at him for a couple of seconds. She must have seen something there, seen the urgency in his eyes.
Okay. But this had better be important. If this is some stunt, I'm not going to be amused.
It's life or death, literally. She nodded and wadded her apron into a ball.
Okay, then.
She threw the apron in a heap with the broken dishes.
This job really sucked anyway.
The fat tourist stood up.
Hey, what the hell is going on around here? You are a pimp or something, buddy?
Fortunato never got a chance to react. The girl gave the fat man a look of pure hatred, and the light drizzle pattering around him turned into a sudden 5-second torrent that soaked him to the skin.
Let's get out of here,
Water Lily said.
Good Lord! And how many times have you been robbed? She exclaimed, as her eyes roved about the immaculate living room with its plush white carpet, maroon vertical blinds, white baby grand piano, and maroon sectional sofa. Turmini, I do wish you humans would have the sense to legalize narcotics. It would make life so much simpler for so many people. Some of us humans wish that too. It would make such a nice cash crop for developing nations, she answered, drifting over to fondle the petals of an elaborate gardenia and orchid bouquet resting atop the glass coffee table. The air conditioner chattered away, pouring cold air into the room, making it less than comfortable. The gardenias breathed their fragrance into the room, mingling with the smell of coffee, which still lingered from the morning, and the pungent scent of incense. The rest of the table was swept clean, but for a large photo book, All Those Girls in Love with Horses by Robert Vavra. Roulette rested the book in her lap and turned the pages. And which do you love, the girls or the horses? Which do you think? Tachyon responded with an impish smile. He was playing back his phone messages, most of which seemed to be from women. The final message ended, and he switched off the machine and unplugged the phone. So we can have at least a few hours of privacy. She found herself unable to meet the hunger in his gaze, and she dropped her eyes back to the book. Would you like a drink? No, thanks. Tension filled the room, forming almost tangible lines between them. Agitated, Roulette rose and roamed about the room. Two walls were covered by floor-to-ceiling bookshelves with works in several different languages, and in an alcove formed by an outthrust of the wall and flanked by two windows was what could only be described as an altar. A low table covered by an embroidered gray cloth held a simple but profoundly beautiful flower arrangement. A single candle, a small knife, and a tiny Hopi seed pot holding a long, thin incense stick. Is this really for worship, he said, turning from the small efficiency kitchen where he was pouring himself a drink. Yes, that's that ancestor business I told you about. That opened a whole set of disturbing memories. Singing in the choir at the Methodist church back home. Her mother rehearsing the angels for the Christmas pageant. her head bobbing energetically as she pounded out the melody on their old piano, and the children's voices like piping crickets filling the house. Being frightened by a hell and damnation sermon by a visiting missionary and clinging to her father for comfort. She flung herself to the piano, seating herself on the cushioned bench. A violin, its smooth golden curves, softly reflecting back the light from a brace of track lights, lay on the piano. And for the first time she found some disorder in this perfect room. A jumble of scores and music sheets marched across the stand. Roulette frowned and leaned in, studying the notation on one of the hand-scored pieces. The notes seemed to be in the familiar positions, but there were odd notations in the clefs. The piano cover fell back with a thud, and she sight-read through the music. She was very aware when Tachyon came up behind her, for the sense of tingling magnetism increased, and the delicate scent he favored washed over her. Ice tinkled in the glass as he attempted to clap. "Bravo! You are quite accomplished." "I should be. My mother's a music teacher."
"Where?"
"Philadelphia public school system." There was a slight pause, then the Takesian asked, "What did you think?"
"Very Mozartian."
A tiny line appeared between Tachyon's arching brows, and he closed his eyes, as if in pain.
"What a blow."
"I beg your pardon?" "No artist likes to be told they are derivative." "Oh, I'm sorry." He held up a small hand, grinned. "Even when they know it's true." She turned back and shuffled the sheets and went on to the second page. "Derivative or not, it's pretty." "Thank you. I'm glad my small effort pleased you. But let us play a true master. I so rarely find someone I can..." He paused and shot her a glance alight with mischief. "Jam with." He flipped quickly through the piles of music and pulled out Beethoven's sonata for violin and piano in F, the so-called Spring Sonata. She watched, held by the way his small, elegant hands caressed the polished surface of the violin, tightening a string here, plucking a single quivering note from another. "Which do you prefer?" she asked, indicating the piano and the violin.
"I can't choose. I am partial to this. Another stroke to the wood of the violin, for it kept me on the edge of the gutter rather than in it for a number of years."
"Pardon?"
"Old history. Shall we tune?"
The A hung trembling in the room, matched by a floating tone from the violin.
"Good God, what is that? A Stradivarius?"
"Don't I wish? No, it's a Nagivari."
"Oh, that chemist in Texas who thinks he discovered the secret of the Cremona school."
The violin dropped from his chin and he smiled down at her.
"What a delight you are. Is there nothing on which you're not informed?"
"I dare say a thousand things," she replied dryly.
His lips pressed against the corner of her mouth, drifted down her neck, the breath puffing gently and warmly across her skin.
"Shall we play?"
And she noticed with embarrassment and anger the catch in her voice. They began in perfect unison, the violin singing the first held note, then gliding into the elegant ornamentation. She echoed the phrase, and time ceased, and reality withdrew. 20 minutes of perfect harmony and graceful genius. 20 minutes without word or thought or worry. A perfect moment. Tachyon stood transported, eyes closed, lashes brushing at his high cheekbones, metallic red hair curling across the violin, joy on his narrow face. Roulette laid her hands in her lap, stared down at the keys, while Tachyon, also remaining silent, placed the violin in its case. Moments later, his hands touched her shoulders, resting like nervous birds, as though frightened to remain. Roulette, you make me feel, well, something that I haven't felt for many, many years. I'm very glad you came walking down Henry Street today. Perhaps there was even a reason for it. She watched with rather distant interest as her fingers tightened about each other, knuckles whitening with strain. You're looking for significance again. I thought you only warned me against looking for comfort. Well, add significance to it. She lifted a corner of the numbing blanket with which she had covered her emotions and found panic throbbing in time to her rushing heartbeats. She probed at her soul and found a bleeding wound. Fear, hate, guilt, regret, hopelessness. She blamed him. Let's go to bed. And she was startled by the flatness of the words when they masked so much anguish.
It would have been quicker to travel cross town underground. Jack had clattered down the steps at the West 4th Street station, one level, two levels, three. Few people other than maintenance workers went down to the fourth level. He went through an anonymous steel door and entered an east-west maintenance tunnel. In their little cages, the dim safety bulbs shed a brittle yellow glow, casting islands of illumination along the passageway. Jack's shoes scuffed in dirt. It was exhilarating to be able to stride along without having to account for endless numbers of slower pedestrians getting in his way. Jack checked his watch, and then looked at it again, unbelieving. It was only a little after two. It seemed as if he'd been searching the city for Cordelia for days. More to the point, he'd completely lost track of time. He wondered if maybe he was squandering his time now. Maybe he should be calling Rosemary, checking with Vagabond, phoning the police, anything. He should have been watching instead of thinking. When he swung around a dogleg in the passage and slammed into someone coming the other way at a dead run, he had, at first, only the briefest impression of a dark figure. He glimpsed one huge eye centered in the other's face, a monocle glittering in the dim light.
"Son of a bitch!"
said the other person, raising one hand toward Jack. Red flame erupted from the fist. A rolling wave of painful sound crashed against Jack's ears, and he heard something buzz past his head, spanging against the concrete wall of the corridor. Cement chips sprayed the side of his face. There was no pain yet.
"Hey!"
Jack yelled. He dropped to the floor of the tunnel, and the epinephrines took over. Now it was all instinctual. All the pent tension of the long day, the frustration of his search, his intermittent desire to kill something, flashed into critical mass. Also, he was hungry. Very hungry.
"Bastard! Get away from me! You die!"
The dark figure drew down with the pistol. Another shot. Jack saw the sparks where the bullet hit a steel stanchion.
"What the hell you doing?"
Jack cried.
"Ah!"
said the reptile brain, flooded with welcomed hormones. Jack felt his body elongate, the vestigial tail extending and swelling, clothing ripping, his snout springing forth before his eyes. The rows of teeth sprang up faster than anything sowed by Cadmus. His claws scrabbled for purchase on the hard-packed earthen floor. He hissed with anticipation.
"Hungry,"
he thought. There was anger too, but mostly hunger. The man with the pistol backed into the corner of the dogleg. He held something shiny in his other hand. He stared unbelievingly at the alligator.
"Get the fuck away!"
Jaws scissoring open wide, the alligator lunged forward. Brief thunder rolled as the pistol flashed and a bullet nicked the creature's armored hide above one front leg. The jaws slammed closed with incredible force as the man screamed and thrust his hands out in a hopeless attempt to fend off the beast. The pistol skittered away, lost in the darkness. The plastic-wrapped package went into the alligator's mouth, along with the hand that held it, along with part of an arm, the man's shoulder, and his face. His bubbling screams stopped in a matter of seconds. Glass shattered as the monocle spun away and smashed against the tunnel wall. The alligator wrenched his jaws away from the remains of the corpse. There was no chewing. The food went down his gullet where the powerful enzymes would take care of assuaging his hunger. He opened his jaws again to roar a challenge. No one and nothing answered him. The alligator swung his head heavily from one side of the corridor to the other. On some deep level, he remembered that food was not his only priority this day. He started forward into the darkness. There was something he had to do.
A cab? Water Lily said. I thought we were in a hurry.
It'll get the job done, Fortunato said. We don't want any grandstand moves. Not today. The cab pulled over and they got in. Empire State Building, Fortunato told the driver. He leaned back in the seat. We don't need to make targets of ourselves.
It's the astronomer, isn't it?
He just killed Kid Dinosaur, tore him to pieces. He would have killed Demise, but Demise was tougher than anybody knew. You probably heard about the Howler, so it's... He broke off. Jane had stopped listening somewhere in the middle.
Kid Dinosaur? She said.
Fortunato nodded.
Jesus.
She stared straight ahead. Water, not tears, beaded up on her cheeks. Fortunato couldn't tell if she was going to cry for real or start ripping up the cab's upholstery. Finally, she said,
All right.
The words came out small and strangled. She tried again.
All right. Count me in. Where do we start?
This isn't working, Fortunato thought. She's not going to go weak and helpless on you. She's gotten too tough for that. What do you do when they don't want your protection? He said. How about a bodyguard assignment?
What? Are you serious? Guarding who?
I was thinking of Hiram Worcester.
Oh, that fat guy?
He identified the astronomer's coins. He could be in danger, too.
Oh, all right, she said. For now.
An establishment as celebrated and unique as Aces High drew its share of trouble, and Hiram had long ago resigned himself to the unfortunate necessity of security. But he insisted that it be discreet. Peter Chow's men and women were quick, efficient, highly skilled, and very unobtrusive. When it came to dealing with drunks, hold-up men, and leapers, no one was better. But the astronomer was more than they'd been trained to handle. Modular Man was about as unobtrusive as a joker in Idaho. The android had a certain male model handsomeness, although his prefab features were without either character, lines, or hair. He wore a skullcap to conceal the radar dome built into his head. Twin grenade launchers were mounted on rotating pivots set in the synthetic flesh of his shoulders. The shoulder modules popped right out, and normally Hiram insisted that Modular Man check his armament at the door. But today was not the day for normalcy. When the android landed on the balcony and was ushered into his office, Hiram asked him straight out what sort of weaponry he was equipped with. The left module fires tear gas canisters, and the right is loaded with smoke bombs, Modman said. The smoke will not affect my radar, of course, but will blind any potential adversary. The tear gas...
I know what tear gas does, Hiram said curtly. Your creator is assuming the astronomer has to breathe. Let's hope he's correct.
I could exchange the grenade launcher for an armor-piercing 20mm cannon, Modular Man said cheerfully. Hiram made a choking sound. If you even think about firing a cannon inside my restaurant, you'll never set foot in here again. It's more like a large machine gun, actually, nonetheless, Hiram said firmly. Would you like me to patrol the perimeter? I'd like you to sit at the end of the bar and stay out of the way, Hiram told him. There's still a great deal of work to be done. The guests will begin arriving around 7 for cocktails. If anything's going to happen, it should happen well before that. He escorted the android out to the bar and left him in the company of a bottle of single malt scotch. On the way to his office, Curtis accosted him.
The lobster was the only thing they bothered to destroy, he reported. Some of Gills's employees are cleaning up the damage, the ones who didn't run away. Gills was taken to the Jokertown clinic.
Find out who's in charge and tell them I want the tuna, Hiram said. As much as he has.
We'll do blackened tuna tonight instead of lobster. Paul will not be amused, Curtis said. Hiram paused at the door to his office. Let him scream. Then let him cook. If he refuses, I'll do it myself. I'm not unfamiliar with Cajun cuisine. He paused thoughtfully. Alligator has an interesting taste. You don't suppose that girls might have... No, that's too much to ask. Oh, and offer a premium price for that tuna. If I hadn't interfered this morning, none of this would have happened. You shouldn't blame yourself, Curtis said. Why not? Hiram asked. He snorted. I remember when I was first diagnosed back in 1971. After Tachyon assured me that I wasn't going to die, that I'd been gifted with extraordinary powers instead, I determined that I must use those powers for the public good. Absurd, I know, but it was the tenor of the times. I tell you, Curtis, heroism is a ludicrous career choice, although not half so ludicrous as I was in my costume. He paused thoughtfully and flicked a piece of lint off the swell of his vest. It was well tailored, he said, but ludicrous nonetheless. At any rate, my physique was distinctive, masked or no, and my abortive experiment in semi-professional adventuring ended abruptly when a gossip columnist accurately divined my identity. I'm not a modest man, Curtis, but food is what I'm best at. Gills would be a lot better off if I'd remembered that this morning. He turned away before Curtis could reply and shut the office door behind him. His lunch was waiting on his desk. 3 thick-cut pork chops grilled with onion and basil, a side of pasta salad, steamed broccoli with grated Romano cheese, and a piece of the famous Ace's High cheesecake. Hiram sat down and contemplated it. A newspaper lay next to his untouched lunch platter. The Daily News had already gotten out an extra, and Anthony had brought up a copy with Hiram's tux. The picture spread across the front of the tabloid had been taken at Jet Boy's tomb by some amateur photographer. Hiram supposed that it was a great news photo, but he could scarcely look at it. He found himself averting his eyes from Kid Dinosaur's mutilated body and looking at the faces in the background. Their emotions were plain to read. Horror, hysteria, anguish, shock. Some just seemed baffled. Others stared with unwholesome fascination. In the right-hand corner was a pretty blonde who couldn't have been more than 18, laughing, no doubt amused by some witticism from the boy whose arm she clung to, as yet oblivious to the horror a few feet away. How did she feel when she looked around, the laughter still fresh on her lips? How would she feel when she saw this picture, her laugh frozen there for all time? His lunch was growing cold, but Hiram had no appetite. Kid Dinosaur had been a constant nuisance to the proprietor of Aces High. He remembered one hot summer night when a pteranodon had swooped in through the open terrace doors and buzzed the diners. Drinks were spilled, plates were dropped, the dessert cart tipped over, and half a dozen indignant customers left without paying their bills. Hiram had put an end to the incident by making the creature too heavy to stay aloft and reprimanding him in no uncertain terms. From all reports, the boy had been cowed for almost a week. When the phone rang, Hiram grabbed it quickly. What? He demanded brusquely. He was in no mood for conversation. Me, Hiram, Jay Aykroyd said. Hiram had almost forgotten about the detective. Where are you? He demanded. At the moment I'm at a payphone outside the men's room of the Crystal Palace, being eyed by a joker who looks like a cross between a douchebag and a saber-toothed tiger. I think he wants to use the phone, so I'll get right to the point. Chrysalis knows something. Chrysalis knows a good many things, Hiram said. Real good, Aykroyd replied. Your friend Bludgeon isn't independent. Him and his whole scam are part of something, something a lot bigger. Chrysalis knows how and what, but the price she quoted for the information was way out of my budget. Maybe not out of yours, though. I'm bringing her up tonight. You can talk to her yourself. You're bringing her here, Hiram said. Gee, she's a joker, not an ace. I'm an ace, Aykroyd reminded him, and she's my date. Don't worry, I made a promise to cover her tits. A shame, though. They're nice tits, even if they are invisible. Just pretend she's really British and you'll get on great. Fine, Hiram said. And while you've been arranging your social calendar and studying Chrysalis's breasts, Bludgeon put Gills in the hospital and destroyed my lobsters. I know, Aykroyd said. Hiram was astonished. How could you possibly know? I dropped by Fulton Street before I went to see Chrysalis, Figured maybe I'd see Gills, charm him with a few magic tricks, pull a coin out of his gills, and see if he'd talk to me. I got suspicious right off when I saw a truck burning in the alley. The 7-foot-tall guy was going out as I was coming in. He looked a lot like the guy waiting for the phone, only ugly. I made a citizen's arrest. He's in the tombs.
God, Hiram exclaimed. Jay, this is the first good news I've heard all day. Thank you, and good work. You'll get a month of free dinners for this. Appetizers included, I hope. The thing's not done, though. Bludgeon's locked up for the moment, but sooner or later someone's going to notice him hollering in there, and then they'll count heads and let him go, unless we can get him charged with something. Can you go downtown and do the honors? Hiram felt in a terrible bind.
Jay, I want to, but I can't possibly leave now.
A crisis with the pâté de foie gras? Fortunato is going to be bringing some people by. I need to, stay. Besides, I've never laid eyes on Bludgeon. Gills was the one they assaulted. Have him prefer charges.
He's terrified, Hiram.
If we put Bludgeon away, he has nothing to be terrified of. Tell him that. He can't let them get away with this.
Aykroyd sighed. All right, I'll go talk to him. Hell, on days like this, I wish I could pop myself around. Do you have any idea what the traffic's like out there?
Spectre stared across the Hudson River toward the Jersey shore. He'd grown up in Teaneck. As long as he could remember, he'd hated New Yorkers. Hated them for their contemptuous comments and unending supply of Jersey jokes. They really thought they were better, just by living a few miles away. Every New Yorker he killed was a little revenge for the way he'd always been treated by them. The astronomer knew he was alive by now. The old man was probably too busy to watch TV himself, but had plenty of flunkies to dish him the information. Spectre could only hope that the other aces on the hit list were more important than he was. Hell, there was even a chance the astronomer would buy it. They'd kicked his ass before. If he could manage to stay out of the way, Spectre might be able to read everybody else's obit in the Times tomorrow. The West Side Highway was behind him, already crawling with cars. The docks were busy. Working guys still had to eat. They couldn't take the damn day off to gawk around. Spectre looked back into Manhattan. The Windhaven Tower building was directly across the highway. The apartments in it were exclusive and pricey. The architecture was like something out of a 30s sci-fi pulp, including an open lobby all the way to the top of the building. He followed the unbroken silver line of the tower all the way up. He squinted. There was something, someone, up there. A man in a hang glider pushed off the edge of the roof 20 stories up. He dived for a few seconds, then leveled off and headed out toward the river.
"Cops are gonna put your ass in jail when they catch you, buddy."
Spectre hated heights and shuddered as he thought of falling off a building like that, wings or no. He turned back toward Jersey. There was something coming toward the city from across the river. It was several hundred feet up and moving fast. He recognized the familiar shell. Turtle. So the astronomer hasn't gotten you yet. Spectre liked the turtle about as much as he liked the other aces who'd raided the cloisters, which was not at all. He straightened his shoulders and rubbed his mouth, feeling suddenly vulnerable. If the astronomer tried to take the turtle now, he didn't want to be anywhere close. The turtle slowed down and hovered over the river. A couple of private boats were cruising around nearby, bobbing a little in the light chop, but they didn't seem to be in any kind of trouble. The turtle began to wobble slightly. The hang glider banked and moved directly toward him. Spectre wanted to run, but curiosity held him where he was. The hang glider moved straight and fast toward the turtle. He was less than 100 feet away. There was a sound like glass being cut, and then a loud pop. The glider veered away.
Spectre recognized the noise and knew the turtle was in trouble. One of the last aces the astronomer had lured in was a Puerto Rican kid who he called Imp. He could generate an electromagnetic pulse that neutralized all electricity within 50 yards or so. The cameras and other equipment on the turtle's shell were so much junk now. Imp maneuvered his glider back over the turtle. The wind was slowing him down, making him climb. Longshoremen were setting down their crates, looking out at the river. Moments later, the shell was covered in an explosion of orange flame. Napalm. The boom echoed off the water. As the flames began to die down, Spectre could see that parts of the shell were on fire. The turtle began to wobble even more and fell toward the river. There was a loud slap and hiss as the shell struck the water. One of the nearby boats steered toward the turtle. The shell floated for a second and sank fast, like there were pulleys at the bottom of the river dragging it down. There was nothing left but a little steam on the surface of the river. Jesus, who would have thought it could be so easy? Spectre felt his skin tighten. It was a safe bet that the astronomer had watched the turtle go down just like he had. The other aces weren't going to be much help. The astronomer was knocking them off one by one. They'd only beaten him before because they'd been organized and had taken the old man by surprise. It was the other way around today. Spectre heard approaching sirens. He turned and ran.
"We saw it on TV," Hiram told Fortunato. "First the howler, then the kid. It was dreadful, unbelievable." Fortunato nodded, uncomfortable in the crowded office. Hiram's chef was there, his bouncer, a couple of the waiters. Modular Man came over from where he'd been leaning by the window. "Hello," he said to Jane. "I don't know if you remember me. Modular Man? You can call me Modman for short." Jane nodded to him, brushing him off. "You don't need me here," she said to Fortunato. "You're trying to hide me someplace where I'll be out of your hair." "That's not true," Fortunato lied. "You've seen the astronomer. You know more than anybody how powerful he is. The only hope we have is strength in numbers. All of us together in one place."
"All of us. You included."
"I have to find the others. This is my karma, okay? My responsibility."
"You don't have to do it alone, you know. It's not a crime to let somebody help you." Fortunato didn't say anything. Oh, hell. Why am I wasting my breath? But one thing, if you leave me here and somebody dies or gets hurt that I could have saved, I'm not going to let you forget it. Understand?"
"I can live with that," Fortunato said. Hiram followed him into the hall. Fortunato, can I see you a second?" Fortunato nodded, and Hiram shut the door.
"I got a call a few minutes ago. From a Lieutenant Altobelli, NYPD, looking for you."
"What did he have?"
"He wouldn't say, but he said he needed you at the cloisters, ASAP.
"Okay, well, that's next then."
"Fortunato?"
"What?"
"What about Tachyon?
What about him?
Wasn't the astronomer after him, too?"
"Fuck him. Would it be okay if I at least warned him?" "I don't care," Fortunato said. "Just as long as you don't do anything stupid and don't go off and leave the people I'm bringing here, I'm counting on you, man. Don't fuck up."
"Right," Hiram said cheerlessly. Fortunato's elevator came. He pressed one and jiggled the door close button.
The smell of hot pretzels made Spectre's stomach rumble. Other than a few peanuts at the bottomless pit, he hadn't eaten all day. He walked over to the stand. The vendor was a short, middle-aged man in a light blue shirt and black beltless pants. He smiled at Spectre, showing crooked yellow teeth. He wore a button that said, "Pretzel vendors know how to get twisted."
"What can I do for you?"
"Give me a pretzel." "Make it two." The vendor pulled out the pretzels and wrapped them absent-mindedly.
"Boy, I'll tell you, It would be fine by me if every day was wild card day. I could retire and play the horses.
Spectre took the pretzels and paid him. The vendor had the kind of dim, simple-minded dreams only losers have. Spectre was beyond even having dreams anymore. He just killed people and occasionally wondered why it didn't bother him more. He took a large bite of the pretzel. It was warm and chewy. This would fill him up until he ate at the Haiphong Lily. A wave of nausea and dizziness hit him in mid-stride. He dropped the pretzels and fell to his knees. Darkness was creeping in around the edge of his vision.
"You sick or something, mister?"
he heard someone ask. He saw the limousine pull up next to him. A mirrored window lowered slowly. The astronomer smiled at him. Spectre doubled over and pressed his face to the cold concrete. He didn't have the strength to move. He closed his eyes, fighting for breath. He could still smell the pretzels. A car door slammed. He felt hands lifting him, just as he passed out.
Fortunato introduced her as Water Lily, but she told Hiram she'd prefer to be called Jane. "I know how you feel," he said, with one of his most charming smiles. "They used to call me Fat Man." She seemed shy and sweet, but the way she was dressed would simply not do. Blue jeans had their place, but it was not in Aces High, and her sneakers were unbearably ratty. "A droll fellow, that one," Hiram said conversationally, indicating the smirking likeness of Jumpin' Jack Flash on her faded T-shirt. "Will he be here tonight?" Jane asked him. "I'm afraid not," Hiram said. "He received an invitation via Dr. Tachyon, of course, but he sent his regrets. He did say a friend of his might attend, whatever that means. Come with me, if you please. It's a madhouse out here right now." Hiram escorted Jane through the din of the restaurant to the relative sanity of his office, and buzzed for Anthony. When the chauffeur arrived, he introduced him to Jane and said, "Give him your sizes." "Sizes?" She seemed confused. "The dinner tonight is a formal affair," Hiram explained, "and there's no reason a lovely young lady like yourself shouldn't look her best. It'll have to be off the rack, I'm afraid. We can't have you leaving to go shopping. Fortunato insists that we all stay together, and I think his tactical instincts are sound." He turned to Anthony. "Something in blue or green, I think. Off the shoulder, with hose and accessories. Are you comfortable in high heels, Jane, or would you prefer to wear flats?" "Wait a minute," she said, her eyes wide and apprehensive. "I can't afford a lot of expensive clothing." "Heels," Hiram said, "definitely. You have lovely legs." "Aces High will take care of everything," he smiled. "Don't worry, I'll find a way to deduct it. I have an extraordinary accountant." She shook her head. "No, I'm sorry. I can't let you do that." Hiram was nonplussed. "Why ever not?" he said. "I can't accept a lot of expensive clothing from you as a gift. I can't. I won't." "My dear," Hiram said uncertainly, "you put me at a loss. Mind you, I don't enforce a rigid dress code at the dinner, but it would be a shame if—" Anthony spoke up unexpectedly. "Perhaps the lady would accept the clothing as a loan." Both Hiram and Jane turned to look at him in surprise. "If I may be so bold to suggest it?" "I couldn't," she said, "even as a loan. I quit my job this afternoon, and even if I get another one, I'd never be able to pay you back waiting tables." Hiram stroked his beard thoughtfully and smiled. "You might," he said, "if the tables were at Aces High. Not tonight, of course, but starting tomorrow when we reopen to the public. I promise you, the tips are excellent, and we can always use a good worker." Jane seemed to think it over for a moment. "All right, I'll do that. You can take what I owe you out of my pay." She looked at Hiram evenly, with a ghost of a smile. "Excellent," Hiram said. "Now I'm afraid I've got work to attend to. If you're hungry, find Curtis, and he'll have them bring you some lunch." Hiram found himself staring at the closed door after Jane had gone. She was far too young for him, but she was lovely, with an air of innocence about her that he found very erotic. She reminded him of Eileen Carter, who had been almost as young as Jane when she and Hiram had first met years ago. Innocence and strength, a potent combination. The girl would be lucky indeed if the blend didn't get her killed. He frowned, made a small reflexive fist and thought about the dead. An adolescent boy with delusions of glory, and a big man all in yellow whose shout could crack stone. And Eileen. He must never forget Eileen. That had been a long time ago, 7 years now since Fortunato had come to him with a shiny blood-red penny and Hiram had given him her name, never dreaming that he was sealing her death warrant. Afterward, Hiram had scarcely been able to believe it. Dead? Eileen dead? She helped identify a rare coin, and for that she is dead? Eileen had been his lover years before the virus had taken him for its own. That was over by the time she had gotten involved with Fortunato, but she had still meant a good deal to him. The pimp had bedded her and then gotten her killed, involved her in something she had no more business in than Hiram. The night that Fortunato had broken the news had been one of the worst nights of his life. As he had listened to Fortunato go on about Masons, Hiram could taste the bile in the back of his throat, could feel the rage rising in him. He had never used his spore-given ability to kill, but that night he had come close. He had flexed and unflexed his fingers, watched the gravity waves shimmer about the tall black man with the almond-shaped eyes and the bulging forehead, and wondered just how much weight Fortunato could stand. 500 pounds? 1,000? 2,000? Would his heart burst before or after those long, wiry legs shattered under the weight of his body? Hiram could find out. Just make a fist, a tight, hard fist. He hadn't done it, of course. Hadn't done it because he realized something as he listened to Fortunato's voice. It was nothing the man said. He was not the sort of man to make such admissions. Yet it was in his tone and in the look of those dark eyes snug in their epicanthic folds. Fortunato had loved her too. Had perhaps loved her more than Hiram, who had his father's large appetites and wandering eye. And so he'd relaxed his half-made fist, and instead of hate, Hiram had felt a strange bond to the sharp-tongued sorcerer pimp. Afterward, he had tried to put it all behind him. He made no pretensions to heroism, whatever powers he might have. Crimes were the domain of the police, justice a matter for gods. His business was feeding people well and making them a bit happier for a few hours. But as he remembered Eileen and Kid Dinosaur and the Howler, and worried about Gills and Sweet Young Water Lily and Dr. Tachyon and the other names on the astronomer's death list, Hiram Worcester could feel the rage building once again, the way it had risen inside him that night in 1979. This astronomer was an old, old man, Fortunato said. He probably wouldn't be able to take very much weight at all. Hiram regarded his cold luncheon plate for a moment, and then lifted his knife and fork, and methodically began to eat.
Spectre kept his eyes closed when he came to. He knew he was in the astronomer's limo. He could feel a person sitting on either side of him. The one on the left had bony elbows. The old man, he figured.
"Don't play possum on me, Demise. It won't do you any good."
The astronomer jabbed his elbow into Spectre's ribs. He opened his eyes. There was a middle-aged woman on his right. Her facial features looked like a caricature of someone beautiful, and she wore no makeup. Her dress was white cotton with padded shoulders and a narrow waist. She avoided looking directly at him.
"Nothing to say. But then you never were the talkative type."
The astronomer put a hand on his left arm.
"I trust I have your undivided attention."
Spectre looked into the astronomer's dilated eyes. He tried his power. Maybe this time it would work. No go. He slid his hand inside his coat, reaching for the Ingram. Both the gun and holster were gone. The old man shook his head.
"I took it away. It's pathetic. You're being reduced to carrying a gun. You're lucky I found you again."
"The turtle's dead, isn't he?"
"Yes."
The astronomer rubbed his palms together.
"It's so easy when you know what's going to happen, and they don't."
"How'd you set it up?" Spectre asked.
Our good friend Captain Black arranged to send out a misleading distress signal over the police band.
The astronomer put a finger to his wrinkled forehead.
You just have to outthink your enemies. That's all.
Imp was lucky to get that close. Spectre pushed back into the soft upholstery and sighed. He didn't have any cards left to play.
Hardy luck. Turtle was having blood sugar problems. Right, my dear?
Rather severe ones, the woman said. Even worse than what I did to Mr. Spectre.
Demise, my dear. Call him Demise.
The astronomer tightened his grip on Spectre's arm.
Say hello to Insulin, Demise. She's my new star pupil.
Hello, Sugar, he said sarcastically. She still wouldn't look at him. I'm alive. You must want me for something if I'm still alive. Who do you want me to kill?
All that's being taken care of by my more trustworthy associates. No, I'm keeping you alive for another reason. This Fortunato,
the astronomer made a fist with his free hand.
I want him to suffer before I kill him. He has women. You and I are going to entertain some of them tonight. You always did enjoy that, didn't you, Demise?
Yeah. What time? Spectre didn't believe it was going to be this easy. The old man still had a hold of his arm.
Late, very late.
Fine.
Still, I must punish you for trying to hide from me. You need to be reminded of your place.
No, he said, trying to pull away. The astronomer grabbed his arm with both hands and twisted. The bones in Spectre's forearm snapped. Grinding pain shot up his arm into his shoulder. He clawed at the old man, tearing flesh from his cheeks and knocking his glasses off. The astronomer held the broken bones together at an oblique angle.
Any power you have, Demise, I can use against you. I can brain wipe everything but the memory of your death, and I can mutilate you until you look like something from a Joker's worst nightmare.
Spectre could feel the bones knitting together. His arm looked like a third frozen joint had been added to it. He tried to pull away, but the astronomer held him fast.
I think he's all better now, Insulin. He won't cross us again.
The astronomer turned his arm loose.
Look what you fucking did to me!
Spectre screamed. The astronomer picked up his glasses and propped them back on his nose.
There are much worse things waiting if you disappoint me again. Driver, stop the car.
The limo pulled over to the curb. Insulin opened the door. She looked at his twisted arm and smiled. Wait till he gets pissed at you, Spectre thought, crawling over her and stepping out onto the sidewalk. I hope he turns you inside out.
Tonight, be ready. I'll come for you when it's time, the astronomer said.
Insulin closed the door. The limo pulled out into the traffic. Spectre looked up. People were pointing at him, laughing like it was some kind of joke. Others turned away. The Pan Am building was a few blocks away down Park Avenue. They would have to drop him in the middle of Midtown. He rubbed his arm. He couldn't rotate his wrist anymore. A helicopter took off from the top of the Pan Am building. Spectre wished he was on it, and then shook his head. There was no place on the planet where anyone was safe from the astronomer. He walked quickly down the street, wishing he had time to kill each and every person who looked at him funny.
Chapter 10. 3 p.m. The bedroom continued the maroon motif, but with highlights in gray rather than white. More books, more flowers,
and on the dresser the photo of a sad-eyed woman in the dress of the 1940s. An enormous walk-in closet filled with clothes, a riot of color. Tachyon seated in a chair by the window, eased off one high-heeled boot. The air conditioner set the crystal and silver wind chime above his head to ringing. Let me. She knelt before him and pulled off the second boot, noting how small his feet were, contrasting it with Josiah's size 12s. I should be undressing you. She dropped the boot. How about we move things along and undress ourselves? I am either flattered that you're so eager, or worried because you're simply anxious to have the deed done. Her fingers froze on the buttons of her blouse, and she watched in the mirror while the color drained from her face, leaving behind that strange gray quality that affects black skin. She hurriedly stripped off her clothes and stared at the slender reflection in the glass. The crystals in her braids gave back the light, sparkling against the ebony hair. Madam, you are beautiful. He made an ivory and carnelian figure next to her, his head with its tumbled red curls just topping her shoulder. Her lips skinned back from her teeth in a travesty of a smile. Come on, I'll thank you in bed. The mattress gurgled and swayed as they settled beneath the coverlet. He reached for her, then rolled away and unplugged the bedside phone. With a wink and a leer, he snuggled against her. His hands and lips played expertly across her body, finding the pleasure points, dissolving her nerves into a wash of sensation. This time it was not an obligation to be bitterly endured. He was an accomplished lover, seeming almost to worship her with his body. His fingers swept aside the moisture-matted hair of her mons, and his tongue teased along the lips of her, tantalizing her clitoris. She tangled a hand in his hair and pulled him closer. For a moment, past and future were forgotten in the all-enveloping sensation of the moment. He wriggled up the length of her, his penis hot, stiff, and moist against her thigh. The head of his cock probed like a nuzzling foal at her mons. She sighed, spread wide, welcoming him. But he continued to tease, his arms rigid on either side of her body, teeth worrying at her nipples, the maddening almost penetration, a hot presence against her clit. She growled and jerked him down to her, capturing his mouth as he slid smoothly into her. And she sensed several things simultaneously. The feather-like brush of his mind sliding harmlessly off the shields that had been erected by the astronomer to prevent just this sort of penetration. And the surging weight of the poison advancing like a questing hunting dog with tiny half-starts and halts, waiting for permission. A permission that she withheld, justifying the decision in a half-formed thought that she would toy with him, promise him love, so the betrayal would be all the more devastating for him. Her arms and legs twined about him, and she met each thrust with an uplift of the hips. His cries were punctuated with gently murmured endearments, but she bit back any sound, as if by silence she could deny the pleasure. He came. Semen fountaining within her, gave a harsh cry and collapsed across her chest, crushing her bosoms between them. Roulette, I think you're an ace. The words punctuated by pants. No, she pushed him aside, and he lay blinking bemusedly up at her. Your shields or not, the inchoate shields formed by normals. These are very sophisticated. She knelt, swaying on the bed, hands clenched between her thighs, the sweat growing clammy on her bare skin,
I can't explain it. If you will permit me to probe, I might be able to explain it.
No! No, it frightens me. I don't want you to. I won't let you. The shrill tones drilled through her, sending a stabbing pain between her eyes.
All right, all right. His hand soothed her as one would a restive horse. Your body and mind are yours to command. I would never violate you. She flung herself down next to him, burying her face against his side, tasting the salt sweat, inhaling the scent of man and sex and aftershave. Hold me. I don't want to think anymore. Hush. Hush. You're safe with me. And he again stared in confusion as her laughter filled the room, mad splinters of sound that seemed to cut at her throat and fill her chest with pain.
Suzanne! I'm cool. It's okay. Vagabond had sat back and taken a deep breath.
So strong.
What is it? Rosemary's voice had been filled with genuine concern. Vagabond looked back at her.
He's got the books, I think. The notebooks.
Jack? How? Rosemary spread her hands in confusion.
He ate them.
Then they're mine. Rosemary's eyes shone, and she bit her lip in thought. The conversation stopped abruptly as four men walked into the office, and Rosemary was pulled into a quick conference with the NYPD's Organized Crime Task Force on where hotspots were likely to develop. To Vagabond, the men were ciphers, administrative types. With the police already spread thin, no one needed a major gang war. It was all too possible, according to Rosemary. The other families were likely to strike at the Gambiones, but they would move slowly, testing for the Gambiones' strength and leadership. The Immaculate Egrets were the greatest danger, outdistancing the Colombians, the Bikers, and even the Mexican Herrera family. The Egrets were not known for caution, restraint, or patience. If the Gambiones did not reestablish their power very quickly, they would be destroyed. None of the men liked the Gambiones, but they all feared the alternative. While Rosemary discussed the reaction of the five families, Vagabond sat quietly on her chair in a corner behind Rosemary's desk. Eyes closed, allowing the conversation to weave around her, she tracked Sewer Jack. He had retreated to the tunnels where he felt safest, but every time Vagabond attempted to influence him to stop moving, he resisted. Although the alligator did not understand precisely why he searched or for what, he kept looking. Tracing the quest further into his brain, Vagabond found that the alligator had made a connection between Cordelia and a particularly tasty bit of food. Discovering that, Vagabond nearly lost contact as the humor of it overcame a portion of her concentration. Wait until she told Jack. Bringing herself back into sync with the reptile, she moved through his brain and carefully changed a few of the neurochemical connections between his legs and his brain, modifying the resistance in the neurons. This done, the alligator moved virtually in slow motion. Vagabond blinked and brought Rosemary's office back into focus, beginning with the portrait of Fiorello LaGuardia on the far wall. The men had left. Rosemary sat at her desk, reviewing a file. "Welcome back to the real world." Rosemary closed the file. "So, where's Jack?"
"Somewhere under the Bowery, as best I can tell." She blinked. "Do you really think it is? The real world?"
Rosemary looked out the window.
"It's the only one I have."
She looked back at Vagabond. "Did you catch much of that conversation?" At Vagabond's shrug, she continued. "I'm supposed to contact my sources and find out what's happening now. After that, I want to go get those books. I'll figure out what I'm going to do with them when I get them." She picked up the phone and began punching buttons. Vagabond watched silently. "Max, this is Rosa Maria Gambione," Rosemary said into the receiver. "I heard there was trouble today. Don Federico..." She reached out and placed the phone on the speaker.
"Long time since you last called, Maria."
"Yes, it has been a long time, but I am still a Gambione."
"Don Federico has passed on," Max said after a pause. Perhaps an accident, perhaps the damned, excuse me, Maria, Chinaman. I do miss your father, Maria. This never would have happened if he was still with us.
My father was a good Don, Max. Is there someone in line to become the new Don?
No, the butcher, excuse me, Maria, thought he would live forever.
What will happen with the family? Vagabond looked up sharply at Rosemary. The assistant DA's tone held more than intellectual concern, and she looked worried. Her hands were curled, the knuckles livid.
There is a meeting tonight at 8 at the Haifong Lily. The younger capos find it amusing to meet there, and the food is good. The capos will decide who will be the next Don. Forgive my impertinence, but I hope they choose more wisely this time.
I'm sure they will, Max.
Maria, if you give me your phone number, I could let you know what happens.
No, I'm never at home, and I hate answering machines.
I can't believe that a nice girl like you hasn't found a husband yet. You can't mourn Lombardo Lucchese forever, you know. Don't let that tragedy ruin your life.
Thank you, Max. I'm not. You know how picky I am, my father's daughter.
Yes, you are, strong and smart like him. Please don't be such a stranger, Rosa Maria. We all miss you.
Vagabond's eyes widened as she listened to Rosemary's conversation. Rosemary picked up a ballpoint from her desk and threw it at her. Take care, Max. I'll speak to you soon. Ciao.
Ciao, Maria.
The phone squealed when Rosemary switched off the speaker. And what's so funny, Suzanne?
Oh, Max, I'm just too busy being a district attorney to have a family. They really don't know?
Suzanne Malotti, God will get you for that. Of course they don't know. Rosemary Muldoon is black Irish and doesn't look a thing like Maria Gambione, the only 20th century Madonna. I haven't seen any of them in person since my mother's funeral years ago, and I wore a wig, veil, and no makeup for that. Rosemary shook her head. Why would they make the connection? Everybody around here just figures I read the right books in school and somehow know the right people to be an expert on the families. They also allow me the factor of good luck.
God already has.
Vagabond leaned back in her chair and tilted her head to one side.
You really are worried about the Gambioni's welfare, aren't you? The Gambioni's are still your family.
If the balance of power shifts, we'll have a disaster. Rosemary stood up.
Bullshit. Let's go get Jack.
Rosemary opened her mouth to reply, but the phone beeped at her and the disembodied receptionist's voice spoke.
Ms. Muldoon, I've got a problem here. Sergeant Fitzgerald is calling from the tombs. It seems that someone, teleported, I think he said, an alleged criminal into the tombs.
Mother of God, why today? Rosemary stared at the phone as if she wanted to explode.
Patricia, isn't Tomlinson on call this afternoon?
Well, yes, Ms. Muldoon, that's what my sheet says, but he's still out to a late lunch and everyone else I've tried is either in conference or away from their desk.
I'll just bet they're in conference. Rosemary sighed and sat down again.
I'll take it.
Vagabond didn't believe Rosemary's protests of uninvolvement with the Gambionis. The books had become an excuse for Rosemary to be reunited with her real family. It angered Vagabond that she had been maneuvered into aiding Rosemary in that goal. It also made her jealous of Rosemary's past. Vagabond blocked out the office and tracked down Jack, still treading his reptilian path toward his prey. It took time to scan for him, even at his current slow pace. When she located him, she returned to the office to find Rosemary watching her balefully. Sergeant Fitzgerald, soon to be Officer Fitzgerald, is hysterical. He is also incoherent. I've got to get down there now. Why don't you come along and we'll leave from there? Vagabond nodded at her as Rosemary reached for the intercom. Patricia, try and find Goldberg for me. Tell him to meet me at the elevator. Rosemary grabbed her jacket off the back of the chair. Let's go before anything else happens. I want to make this quick.
Why him?
Vagabond put her shoes back on and winced. She walked through the door Rosemary held open for her. Your buddy, Goldberg? Because he's new and he's got to learn how to handle this sort of thing. And besides, I like spreading misery around. Come on. Goldberg waited at the elevator, apparently nervously watching for Rosemary. He nodded at Vagabond as the pair walked up. Suzanne, I believe you've met Paul Goldberg. Rosemary waved at Vagabond. Paul, Suzanne Malotti, a friend and associate of mine.
I'm pleased to meet you, officially, Ms. Malotti.
He smiled at her.
I hope I wasn't too abrupt earlier.
No.
Vagabond punched the down button.
Good. Good.
Paul turned to Rosemary. Ms. Muldoon, may I ask why I'm here? He spread his hands and looked inquisitive. Today is not a good day to give me straight lines, Paul. Rosemary glanced at Vagabond, who was watching the floor numbers change. I'll tell you on the way.
Yes, ma'am, said Paul.
Altobelli met Fortunato at the barricades across the south entrance to Fort Tryon Park. The barricades had been up so long, what with the kid gangs and then the damage the Aces had done rooting out the Masons, they'd become permanent fixtures. There were cops everywhere. As one paddy wagon pulled away, another crawled up to take its place. They were down to the dregs now, skinny, underage kids in jeans and t-shirts, handcuffed and sweaty, some of them bleeding from the face and hands. Altobelli shook his head. He was short, graying at the temples, thin except around the middle.
PC's idea, he said.
The police commissioner had been on the radio all last week, taking a hard line about Wild Card Day.
Nice, huh? Of all the fucking times to pull this kind of stunt. If we'd been on the streets, where we're supposed to be, instead of up here kicking a few kids' asses, maybe we could have saved the Howler or that kid. Not to mention the turtle.
What?
It just come over the wire, Altobelli said.
Couldn't fucking believe it myself. Couple of punk Aces took him out with some sort of scrambler or something. Then they napalmed the poor bastard. Went into the Hudson. They're dragging for the shell. No sign yet.
Jesus. The turtle. If they can get him, Fortunato thought, then we're all finished. There's no hope for any of us.
I'm going to die, he thought. In a way, losing all hope made it easier. Now it was just a question of grace under pressure, saving what he could and letting the rest go. Sometime, he thought, before 4 o'clock, you're going to get your shot. What you have to do is wait for it. Be ready. Don't even think about saving yourself, because you're already lost. What you have to do is kill him. Whatever it costs you, you have to kill him or die trying. His hands were shaking. Not fear, not really. More like sick, helpless rage. He made them into fists. He was squeezing so tight he thought he was going to hurt himself. Before he knew he was going to do it, he had turned around and put his fist through the back window of one of the squad cars. Chunks of safety glass rolled across the back seat like uncut jewels.
Jesus Christ, Fortunato!
Altobelli ran to the car and then looked back at Fortunato's hand.
You okay?
Yeah.
Christ! How am I gonna explain this window?
Say one of the kids did it. I don't care. He flexed his fingers, went through a couple of calming mantras in his head.
Forget the window, okay, Altobelli? Tell me why you wanted me here.
Gangs, Altobelli said, turning reluctantly from the car.
Nobody went to the cloisters after you guys trashed the place, so the kids moved back in. PC thinks to grab some headlines from the jokers by rounding up the kids. Only what happens... There's all these tunnels under the place, and there's bodies down in there.
Show me. Altobelli took him past the barricades to an EMS wagon. There were two bodies on gurneys, side by side. Fortunato pulled the first sheet down. It was one of the kids, with long black hair and a rolled-up bandana around his head. He looked vaguely familiar. There was a wad of cotton where his throat should have been. He was some kind of runner for the Masons, Fortunato said. That's all I know. Altobelli nodded him to the next body. This one had been handsome when he was alive. Bright golden hair, sharp nose and chin. He'd been there at the Jokertown lockup the night Eileen died. He decided Fortunato wasn't worth killing.
Roman,
Fortunato said. I think his name was Roman. He was one of them. He was in jail last I heard. Must have got out on bail or something.
There were half a dozen other kids. We already carted them off. Parts of either two or three girls,
It's hard to say which. The ME can sort that out. Hookers, probably. He glanced up quickly. No offense. And something else that looked like it had been a wooden statue, except it was mostly splinters when we found it. The weird thing was, it had clothes on. Probably another ace, Fortunato said. Some kind of woodman or something. There's one more, Altobelli said. This one's still alive.
He searched through the garbage that littered the alleyway for something heavy. Spectre was tired and unsteady. It was probably some kind of hangover from what that insolent bitch had done to him. The astronomer had to be using up power fast. That was the only reason Spectre was still alive. The astronomer needed him to help recharge his powers, which he'd do later with Fortunato's girls. When they got together to off somebody, there was something about the way Spectre killed people that made it easier for the astronomer to eat their energy, or whatever the hell it was he did to get his power. The astronomer always channeled some of the juice to him. It made Spectre feel great, and not many things could anymore. He might have a chance to kill the old bastard before then if the astronomer was weak enough. Otherwise, the astronomer would get charged to the limit, and then nobody could stop him. He dug into a dumpster and pulled out a broken marble paperweight. It was shaped like a rearing horse, only the head was gone. Spectre knelt down and set his mangled arm against the asphalt. He positioned the paperweight over where the bones had been broken and practiced, bringing it down several times. Then raised his arm as high as he could. He closed his eyes and pictured the astronomer's head under his raised hand. Spectre brought the paperweight down as hard as he could. There was a snap. He ground his teeth together to keep from screaming and did it again. Another snap. He dropped the headless horse and pulled his bones into line. After a minute or two, he let go. His arm was fairly straight. But he still couldn't rotate his wrist. The bones were knobbed and didn't slide over each other the way they should. Spectre shakily stood up, his arm hanging limply at his side. He hurt even worse than usual, and his suit, the only one he owned, was a mess. He walked slowly down the alley toward the street, hoping this was as bad as it would get.
Fortunato stepped carefully over the heavy power cables the cops had strung up in the tunnels. There were arc lights every few feet. The walls were slick and crated with tiny bubbles. Fortunato guessed that one of the Masonic aces must have drilled them with some kind of heat power. The main chamber was 30 feet across. There was a battered Persian rug on the floor. Somebody had ground out their cigarettes on it. The furniture was cheap vinyl junk that had spent some time in the rain. Plainclothes cops in latex gloves were gathering up bits and pieces and putting them in Ziploc bags. One of them had just picked up a disposable plastic syringe. Fortunato took the man's wrist and bent over to sniff the needle. The cop stared at him. Heroin, Fortunato said. Been a lot of it around, the cop said. Cheap as dirt these days. Fortunato nodded, thinking about Veronica. She could be on the street right now, tying off, raising the bright blue vein inside her elbow. Over here, Altobelli said. I don't know what the fuck he is. Fortunato recognized him from Waterlily's description. He was one of the nightmares, a weird little genius who'd rebuilt the Shakti device for the astronomer. His fear and hatred of cockroaches had turned him into one. Kafka, Fortunato said. That's what they call you, isn't it?
Not,
the man said.
To my face, as a rule.
He sat on a tobacco-colored couch in the corner. The parts of him that weren't covered by a white lab coat were the same brown color as the couch. Skinny legs with spikes coming out the back. Hands like tweezers. a flat, noseless face with nothing but lumps where the eyes should have been. Fortunato stood in front of him. All he felt was cold. Where is he?
I don't know, Kafka said.
Why aren't you dead like the others? The faceless head swiveled toward him.
Give me time. I'm sure I will be. Some of those children outside were having some sport with me. By the time I got here, I heard screaming. I hid in a back tunnel.
Did you hear anything else?
He told someone else, a woman, to meet him at a warehouse when she was done. There was something about a ship.
What kind of ship?
I don't know.
Who was he talking to?
I never knew her name. I only saw her once or twice. Besides, my eyes are nearly useless. I could try to describe her smell to you.
Fortunato shook his head. Is there anything else? Anything at all? Kafka thought for another few seconds.
He said something about 4 o'clock. That was all I heard.
Demise had said it was all going to happen by 4 a.m.
A yacht? Fortunato wondered. Some kind of cruise ship?
Not likely. Nothing that traveled on water could take him far enough, fast enough, to keep Fortunato from finding him. Which meant a spaceship. But where in hell would the astronomer be able to come up with a spaceship?
Have them cremate me, will you? Kafka said. I hate this body. I hate the idea of it being around after me.
You ain't dead yet, Altobelli said. For Christ's sake!
As good as, Kafka said. As good as.
On the way back out, Fortunato said, He's right, you know. The astronomer is going to come after him. You need a guard around him at all times, like SWAT guys with M16s.
You're serious, aren't you?
He got the turtle, Fortunato said.
All right, you got it. Procedure in a case like this, the perp goes to the Jokertown lockup. That's Captain Black's turf. But I'll keep a detail of my own guys with him. We've got enough shit on our faces for one day.
They came back up into daylight.
Now look, Altobelli said. You be careful. You see this astronomer character, you call for backup. You understand?
Right, Lieutenant.
Sure you will, Altobelli said. Sure you will.
Chapter 11. 4 p.m. Electrochemical neutral responses diminished. Body slowed to a dreamlike slow motion. The alligator moved among the tunnels deep below the Bowery. The reptile brain wasn't aware of it, but he was moving vaguely in the direction of Stuyvesant Square. The creature that only sometimes was Jack Robichaud sought food, wide-nostrilled snout casting from side to side as he sought to sense the location of a particularly delectable morsel. The morsel had dark brown eyes and glossy black hair, the alligator's mind fixed on that image. The creature padded through pools of cold radiance shed by the low-wattage trouble lights fixed to the tunnel walls. The sort of maintenance crew Jack Robichaud sometimes bossed had presumably left the system on, despite not planning to return to work until after the holiday weekend. The city would foot the electricity bill. No one cared. The alligator turned a corner and entered a much older section of passage. The floor was slab stone rather than concrete. The ceiling lowered. The creature felt the welcome increase of humidity as his feet plopped down now in brackish pools. His unblinking eyes passed incuriously across years of graffiti vandals had scrawled and spray-painted on the stone walls. Near a narrow, branching tunnel, someone with considerable time had incised letters in the rock. Croatoan. The alligator didn't care. He responded only to his basic drives and forged ahead against the awful inertia that tugged him back at every step. Hunger. Still so hungry. So needful. The dark, shallow water now covered the entire passageway. The alligator welcomed it, hoping on a primal level that the level would deepen until the reptile could start to swim. The powerful tail switched slowly with anticipation. His ears detected unfamiliar sounds, and he halted jerkily. Prey? He wasn't sure. Anything could be prey ordinarily, but there was something about the noises. He heard the scrabbling of a multitude of claws on stone, a hissing sibilance of almost voices. They came upon him from around the next bend. There were at least 2 dozen of them, most tiny, as small as the web span of his foot. Others were larger, and a few, the leaders, perhaps a quarter the size of his 12-foot bulk. The larger alligator slowly opened his jaws and bellowed a challenge. The smaller reptiles stopped in a semicircle around him, their eyes glittering in the trouble-light glare. Their damp hides shone moistly, the mossy green most pronounced in the smaller ones. The skins of the larger, older alligators held an overlay of hoary whiteness, a dark bred pallor. The pack started to hiss and grumble as one and started forward. Hundreds of sharp teeth shone bright as polished bone. The larger alligator looked at them and roared again. These could be food, but he didn't want them to be. They were something else. They were as he, even if their forms were much smaller. He closed his jaws and waited for them. The smaller ones reached him first, scuttling up, rearing on their tails and hind legs, and rubbing against his own muscled feet. The hisses, some low and rumbling, most high and sharp, filled the tunnel. They surrounded him only a short time, the smaller, more agile alligators gamboling about, while the larger reptiles nuzzled against their bigger brother. The larger alligator felt something alien, something puzzling, disturbing on all levels. It was not hunger. It was something like the opposite. Then the pack left him, the smaller members again merrily circling a few times before rejoining their comrades down the tunnel and around the next bend. The sound of claws ticking on wet stone receded, as did the scent of other reptiles. The larger alligator hesitated then in his single-minded course. Something tugged at him, urging the creature to turn in the passage and follow after the smaller reptiles, to be part of something bigger, something different from what he already was. Then the sounds and scents faded, and all the alligator heard was dripping water. He turned back to the darkness of the tunnel ahead, and again lifted one foot heavily after the other. The hunger he sought to assuage was somehow more than mere appetite, and right now he knew there was nothing more important than pursuing the image in his head.
Jennifer, spending 2 hours on the street alone, with no money, no shoes, and very little in the way of clothes, was learning what it meant to be hunted. She was afraid to stay for very long in any one place, afraid that the reptilian joker would track her down again. Yet she was afraid to go to anyone for help. She was afraid to return to her apartment in case they'd track her there and discover her real identity. But, with late afternoon coming and night not too far behind, she was afraid to remain out on the street. She'd already ignored 6 indecent proposals, and that could only get worse with the coming of night. She wanted to take some positive action, but she was feeling too harried, too much the hare in the game of hound and hare to come up with a decent plan. She needed a haven, a place of peace and safety where she could take a breather, rest her sore feet, and, above all, think. The sign in front of a small brick and stone building on Orchard Street made her pause. This, she thought, was exactly what she needed. It was a church. The sign in front said, Our Lady of Perpetual Misery. It looked Catholic. Jennifer had been brought up as a Protestant, but her family hadn't been very religious, and she herself harbored no deep religious feelings, none, at any rate, that would prevent her from seeking refuge in a Catholic church. She hurried up the worn stone steps and through the large wooden double doors that opened up into a small vestibule. She stepped inside the vestibule, looked at the doors leading into the nave, and stared. The vestibule itself was a small, windowless room with flagstone paving. Wooden benches stood along its side walls with coat hooks, now all empty above them. The closed double doors leading into the church nave were also wooden. A scene had been painted on them in a naive style that would have been beautiful if the subject matter hadn't been so grotesque. The central figure was a crucified Christ, but a Christ like Jennifer had never seen. He, Jennifer thought of him as he, though she wasn't exactly sure if the pronoun applied in this case, was naked but for a scrap of linen draped around his loins. He had an extra set of shriveled arms sprouting from his ribcage and an extra head on his shoulders. Both heads had aesthetically lean features. One was bearded and masculine, the other was smooth-cheeked and feminine. Blood trickled down both faces because of the crowns of thorns that each head wore. Four pairs of breasts ran down the front of the Christ's body, each pair smaller than the one above. There was a gaping red wound running blood onto the lowest breast on the figure's right side. The Christ was not crucified upon a cross, but rather upon a twisting helix, a convoluted ladder, or, Jennifer realized, a representation of DNA. There were other figures in the background of the scene, subordinate to the Christ figure. One was a slight, lean figure dressed in gaudy clothes that resembled Dr. Tachyon. But like the Roman god Janus, this Tachyon had two faces. One was serene and angelic in profile. It smiled sweetly and had an expression of benevolent kindness. The other was the leering face of a demon, bestial and angry, dripping saliva from an open mouth ringed with sharp teeth. The Tachyon figure held an unburning sun in his right hand, the side of the angel face. In the left hand, he held jagged lightning. There were other figures whose antecedents were somewhat less clear to Jennifer. A smiling Madonna with feathered wings nursing one head of a baby Christ figure at each breast, a goat-legged man wearing a white laboratory coat carried what looked like a microscope while cavorting in a dance, a man with golden skin and a look of perpetual shame and sorrow on his handsome features juggled an arcing shower of silver coins. Inscribed above the tableau were the words, Our Lady of Perpetual Misery. Below that, in slightly smaller letters, was Church of Jesus Christ, Joker. Jennifer pursed her lips. She had heard a little about this offshoot of Orthodox Catholicism that had been embraced by many jokers who had a religious bent. The Catholic hierarchy, of course, wanted nothing to do with the Church of Jesus Christ, Joker, and considered it heresy. It wasn't exactly an underground religion, but nobody who wasn't a joker knew much about it, especially the secret rites that were rumored to be carried on in subterranean crypts that weren't as accessible to the public as the churches themselves were. This was not the time, Jennifer decided, for theological exploration. She was about to turn and leave the church when a sudden sound, a sort of grasping, sucking, squishy noise, came from the other side of the doors leading into the nave. She froze, and the image of Jesus Christ Joker split down the middle as the doors swung open. A figure stood there, vaguely illuminated by the banks of candles that were burning within the nave. It was large and bulky, the height of a normal man and twice as broad, and covered completely by a voluminous cassock that hung to the floor. The figure's hands were hidden in flowing sleeves, and Jennifer could barely make out a glabrous, dead gray face in the shadow of the gown's hood. The face was round and oily-looking, with two large bright eyes covered by nictitating membranes that were constantly blinking. The face had no nose, but a cluster of tendrils hung where the nose should be, twitching and wrestling, covering the Joker's mouth like some kind of weird, unkempt mustache. Jennifer stared, swallowed hard. The figure took another step into the vestibule, and she heard again the faint squishy sound like suckers on stone. The Joker had a strange musty smell to him, as of the sea or of things that lived in it. He regarded Jennifer with his bright, solemn eyes, and when he spoke, his voice was somewhat muffled by the tentacular tendrils that covered his mouth. But Jennifer could understand his words clearly.
"Welcome to Our Lady of Perpetual Misery. My name is Father Squid."
The nictitating membranes on Father Squid's eyes slipped back and forth rapidly over his protruding orbs, although the eyes themselves remained open and staring. He smiled, maybe, behind the fall of tentacles that masked his mouth. At least his cheeks rose, and his voice took on an even more gentle, kindly tone.
"Don't be afraid of me, or of any you would find within these walls, my child. I perceive that you may be in need of help. I would endeavor to assist you if I only knew what you needed."
The priest's words, spoken in plodding sentences, calmed Jennifer immediately. Somehow, she couldn't be afraid of someone who said things like, "I would endeavor to assist you."
"Well, Father, I guess I do need help. I'm not sure that you could help me, though."
"Perhaps," Father Squid said. "Perhaps not. However, I'm sure that your coming to Our Lady of Perpetual Misery was no accident. Perhaps our Lord guided you to our door. Perhaps you should simply tell me your story."
Why not? Jennifer suddenly thought. Perhaps he really could see a way out of this mess.
"All right," she began, then fell silent again. Father Squid nodded, as if he could read the hesitation on her face.
"Do not worry, my child. Everything you tell me will be held in the strictest confidence."
He opened the door and pointed into the nave. His hand, taken outside the voluminous sleeves of his cassock for the first time, was large and gray, with long, attenuated fingers. Jennifer could see faint circular depressions, like vestigial suckers, impressed all over its palm.
"The confessional is within. The priest-penitent bond is well known and universally respected. Everything said there shall be privy between us."
Jennifer nodded. The priest-penitent bond was as strong as that between lawyer and client, and, in fact, was less easily broken. If the priest was trustworthy, that is. She looked at the large, solemn-faced joker and decided she trusted him. Father Squid held open the door and stood aside as she entered Our Lady of Perpetual Misery, Church of Jesus Christ, Joker.
Vagabond shivered as the trio walked through the heavy deco doors at the entrance to the tombs.
"I can see why they call it the tombs," she said.
Paul shook his head. "Goes back more than a century to the first prison they built on this site. This is the third. Originally, the building really did look like an Egyptian tomb."
"I still don't like it."
He touched her on the shoulder. "I know. I may be a criminal lawyer, but I hate jails, too. They make me feel like a trapped animal."
He spoke quietly.
Rosemary, moving briskly ahead of them toward the desk sergeant, apparently didn't hear.
"Most animals are free, unless enslaved by a human."
Vagabond looked at him directly. Paul flinched at her stare.
"True."
Vagabond looked past him.
"I think Rosemary wants you."
The assistant DA had turned away from the desk and was waving at Paul. Flicking her consciousness through a wino rocking on a lobby bench, a man who was no longer humanly aware, Vagabond watched the expression on Paul's face change from confusion to thoughtfulness, and then to interest. She followed Paul up to Rosemary as the assistant DA argued with the desk sergeant. Rosemary was unhappy. "You can't have lost him. This guy was teleported into a cell. How many people teleport into here every day?" Rosemary glared at the bald officer sitting above her. The cop glowered back.
"If he teleported in, he wouldn't come through this desk," said the sergeant. "He didn't come through this desk. He ain't got no paperwork. No paperwork, no way to trace him. He's here. We got no record."
The officer leaned back in his overburdened and creaking chair and smiled down at Rosemary.
"You gotta follow procedure."
He tucked his mini chins against his barrel chest and looked pleased with himself. Rosemary grabbed the edge of his desk with both hands and took a deep breath. Before she could speak, Paul said,
"I believe his name is Bludgeon. The Bludgeon.
He interjected the information into the conversation in an obvious attempt to keep his boss from either apoplexy or killing the desk sergeant. Rosemary swung around to stare at him with wide, angry eyes. "Large, muscular build," Paul continued. "Somewhat like your own."
"Nothing comes to mind."
The sergeant grinned widely as Paul turned to Rosemary, shrugging in resignation. She turned back toward the sergeant. Voice tightly controlled, she said, "Perhaps you could find an officer for me."
"Lots of them around."
The sergeant gestured at the room around them where a number of people, both police and those under arrest, had stopped their own conversations to listen to the exchange. Rosemary closed her eyes and clenched her teeth. Wearily, she said, "Where might I find Sergeant Juan Fitzgerald?"
"Juan," said the desk sergeant, as though pondering a lengthy list. "Why didn't you say so? Juan's down in Block C. Can you find your way, or should I assign an officer to hold your hand in the dark?"
"I know the way."
Rosemary stalked toward the first gate leading down into the cell blocks. Paul and Vagabond trailed her. The corners of Vagabond's eyes crinkled in amusement.
"What's so funny?"
Paul glanced apprehensively at Rosemary's back.
"What she puts up with? I would have ripped his throat out."
Vagabond spoke matter-of-factly, utterly sincerely. Paul looked confused for a moment and then smiled.
"Nah, too many witnesses. Besides, no throat, no information."
He nodded to himself. "What you want to do is invite him to one of those stairwells and then break his kneecaps." Vagabond stopped and looked at him with respect for the first time.
"Right on, Mr. Goldberg. I like that."
"I'm glad." "The name's Paul."
"Suzanne," she said. "You can call me Suzanne." "Will you two come on?" said Rosemary from ahead of them. "I'm not holding this elevator forever. Conduct your romance on your own time."
She stared at them, apparently realizing how flat her joke was falling. Paul and Vagabond exchanged self-conscious glances. "Right." Rosemary got into the car first and punched the floor button. At Block C, they underwent a cursory search before walking through the peeling, tan-painted steel gate. Turning a corner in the cell block, the three of them halted at the sight of the hulking giant nearly filling the entire corridor from one dull green wall to the other. His back was to them. Vagabond uttered a small meow of alarm, and both Rosemary and Paul looked at her.
"The things I do for the city," Rosemary started forward.
"Rosemary Muldoon, District Attorney's Office. What's happening here?" The giant maneuvered to face her. Two men standing beyond him started to speak too.
"My client, this gentleman..."
"I want out!"
"Hold on!"
Rosemary cut them all off. "Fitzgerald, talk to me," she said to the uniformed officer. "You other two, hold that thought and stay right where you are." The lawyer in the light gray Armani suit spoke loudly enough for Rosemary and the others to hear as she passed.
"NYU, I'd venture to guess."
There was no mistaking the tone. Rosemary pulled the 6-foot Puerto Rican officer down the hall. Vagabond glanced at Paul and nodded toward Bludgeon.
"Keep an eye on him."
"Great."
Paul smiled at the lawyer and the towering man beside him. He stuck out his hand.
"Paul Goldberg, DA's office. How's it going?"
Vagabond followed Rosemary. "Just what is going on?" the assistant DA said to Fitzgerald. "Who's the snappy dresser?"
"He says he's from Latham Strauss."
The officer looked abashed at Rosemary's expression of disgust and disbelief.
"Not bad for an oversized punk," she nodded.
"What exactly happened?"
"This bludgeon just popped in. Had to be Poppin' Jay. Jay Aykroyd."
"I've heard the name," Rosemary shrugged. "The city doesn't need any more vigilante do-gooders."
"Well, he's done it before, no problem. He comes in and files charges later, but this time he never showed. I read Bludgeon his rights and let him make his phone call."
Fitzgerald gestured at the dapper man examining the gold clasp of his briefcase.
"Then, 20 minutes ago, that guy shows up."
"Wonderful."
Hand over her mouth, Rosemary stared at the ceiling as if waiting for inspiration. The lawyer came up to them.
"Excuse me, but my client would like to leave now."
The shade of his Armani was the precise gray of his hair. He had an unctuous smile.
"Well, Mr. Tully, ma'am. Simon Tully." Mr. Telly, there are a number of serious charges against your client.
Rosemary shook her head in concern.
Oh? Said Telly. I was not aware that there were any charges against him.
I don't think it would be in the public interest to release Mr. Bludgeon without thoroughly investigating this matter. Vagabond nodded in agreement. Tully frowned past Rosemary at Vagabond.
And who is this other lovely lady?
An associate, Miss Malotti. Rosemary looked at Vagabond and then quickly back at Tully. Bludgeon's lawyer extended his hand. Vagabond stared down at it as if inspecting a piece of rotting meat.
Charmed, I'm sure.
Tully took a breath and shifted his attention back to Rosemary.
I don't want to bring up false arrest as a potential problem, Ms. Muldoon, but you should seriously evaluate your position.
Mr. Tully, as you so astutely have pointed out, your client has not been officially arrested yet.
False imprisonment, then.
I am beginning to lose my patience. Tully looked down his long, aristocratic nose at Rosemary. Where are the charge sheets?
The paperwork is undoubtedly a little slow today, the holiday and all. I've just had a little problem with that myself.
Rosemary shifted her hands and smiled innocently at Tully.
I do have to consider the community's welfare. And I am here to protect my clients. We are leaving. Now.
Tully showed his teeth and pranced back toward Bludgeon.
Tully, Rosemary started toward them. Show me a witness. Show me a witness's statement. No? Then he's mine, or I'll file against the city.
Tully possessively grasped Bludgeon's arm. The giant grinned at Rosemary and Vagabond.
Bye now,
he said to them in a high-pitched voice ill-suited to his size.
I'll see you again. Real soon, I hope.
Bludgeon watched for the women's response. When he failed to get one, he glared and preceded Tully to the gate. Fitzgerald flattened himself against the wall as they passed. Rosemary looked at Paul and laughed bitterly.
Say to yourself, I love the Bill of Rights, three times.
She lifted her right hand and massaged her temples.
You two go ahead. I want to ask Fitzgerald a couple things. I'll meet you out front.
Vagabond and Paul were silent in the elevator. Paul looked depressed. Walking out into the sunlight was like coming up from deep water into the air. The lawyer sat down on one of the worn marble steps.
I worked in corporate law for years. Mergers, takeovers, leveraged buyouts, the whole routine. Then I decided I wanted to make a difference, to contribute. Payback, you know? So I got a job here.
He rapped the stone with his knuckles.
Some difference, huh? We're trapped by our own strengths.
I realized that a long time ago.
Vagabond shrugged and watched the yellow torrent of passing cabs. Idly, she shifted a portion of her consciousness into the pigeons sitting on the roof of the tombs and looked out across the crowds.
But you've just got to give something back. There's a responsibility.
Paul looked up at the woman, staring blindly into the sky.
Vagabond started. You're the second person today to say that to me.
A pigeon swooped down almost to her shoulder, but she guided it away before it could land.
Maybe you're right.
Paul hesitated, then said,
I realize this is abrupt, but I have to say something.
The woman focused her attention on him.
You're the most intriguing person I've met in this city.
Rosemary will be thrilled, Vagabond said.
Rose, Ms. Muldoon is my boss. Besides, she isn't my type. A bit too conventional.
Paul stood up and faced her.
I'm not conventional?
Vagabond was amused, wondering how different he thought she was.
No offense, please. I was wondering if we could have dinner sometime.
The attorney watched people scale the steps behind her left shoulder.
Sorry, you make me very nervous.
Thanks, but I work most nights.
Vagabond was confused. A part of her actually wanted to do this.
Okay, then. What about breakfast?
Breakfast?
Sure. I run 6 miles really early, about 5. Then I go home and get ready for work. If I feel like it, I go get a big breakfast before coming in. It ruins the road work, but tastes great.
He smiled at her and cocked his head a little to one side.
Join me one day? Just for the breakfast?
All right.
Vagabond nodded and then hesitantly smiled. For the first time, the smile was reflected in her eyes as well.
Yes, I might like that.
How about tomorrow?
She stared at him, once again without expression.
Don't tell me you have another date, Paul said.
What time?
7. I can pick you up.
I'll meet you.
Where? Vagabond concentrated on suppressing the thought that she was making a big mistake.
The market, at Greenwich and 7th.
You two look deep in thought. Rosemary strode down the steps. I know that Popinjay was trying to help, but there are times I wish Aces wouldn't get involved. It would make my life simpler. Yours too, Paul. She shook her head ruefully. Paul, go on back to the office. Work with Chavez. Suzanne and I have some business to take care of. See you later, he said to Vagabond, shaking hands with her. As the two women watched Paul walk back toward the DA's building, Rosemary looked at Vagabond speculatively. He likes you, you know. Of course Jack's a union man and undoubtedly makes a lot more money, but Paul has certain attractions. Rosemary cocked her head and narrowed her eyes. Great ass.
20th century Madonna?
That was a long time ago. She changed the subject. Where's Jack?
Let's go someplace quiet where I can concentrate. I need an alley.
Vagabond started to walk toward the corner.
An alley? Said Rosemary. You hang out in the classiest places. Didn't anyone ever tell you to stay out of Manhattan alleys?
She caught up with Vagabond and they crossed Lafayette Street. Places like that? People can get killed.
The darkness in the confessional was somehow soothing. The air in the box smelled even more strongly of the sea, and Father Squid's bulk was a comforting presence on the other side of the frosted glass window. He made small sighing sounds as he considered Jennifer's story.
I believe that I know of the Joker who is accosting you, the priest finally said. He is not of my children, but there are few Jokers who have not come by at least once or twice to hear the word. He goes by the name Worm. His reputation is not the best.
Father Squid fell into a meditative silence that lasted for some minutes.
I am perplexed, but perhaps understanding will come. Come.
He rose to his feet, swept back the heavy drapery that curtained his side of the confessional, and stepped out of the box. Jennifer followed.
I must make some inquiries.
He held up a broad, spatulate hand and wiggled his long fingers to silence the question he saw on Jennifer's face.
Never fear. I shall be most subtle and circumspect. Make yourself comfortable. Rest. You are as safe here as if you were in your own home. Perhaps infinitely safer if your suspicions are correct.
His cheeks bunched again as if he were smiling, and Jennifer nodded. She watched as Father Squid waddled off, making faint squishing sounds on the flagstone flooring as he went with ponderous dignity to the rear of the church.
Roulette was approaching climax, and she tried to resist, the effort causing her thighs to cramp and nausea to wash about the tendrils of fire that filled her belly and groin. Tachyon, with a damnable sensitivity, fixed his pale eyes on her and slowed his thrusts, his hands caressing her breasts, sweeping down her sides. Release! And as quickly as the command was given, it was withdrawn. The tide sank back, growling its frustration in a voice that was the astronomer's. Her mind and body were once more in harmony, no longer rent by her fear and indecision. Her passion rose, and she rocked in a frenzied rhythm, matching each thrust of his small, compact body. The shrill ring of the front bell tore through the apartment. Beneath her hands, she felt his muscles tighten and leap, and his cock slid free. Damn, 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 he whispered, urgently trying to fit himself once more into her. She reached down to help, and their hands bumped and tangled, sliding on the slick skin of his penis. Ring! He was finally in, but the ringing persisted, and he lay flaccid and inert atop her. He sighed, briefly closed his eyes, and said, I think the moment is ruined. Yes. Shall I answer the door? I don't think they'll go away otherwise. Wait here. He rose and shrugged into an elaborate brocade dressing gown of black silk, shot through with threads of silver and red. It was too long, and the hymn whispered across the smoke-gray carpet. He was careful to close the bedroom door behind him, and she wondered if that was to protect her reputation or his. Folding her arms beneath her head, she stared up at the ceiling and listened to the sounds of muffled conversation from the front room. A strange thumping sound followed by a crash brought her upright in the bed, sheets slithering to her waist. And with a harsh rasp, the bedroom window was forced up, and the delicate fabric blinds kicked aside. Rillette screamed, and the foot was withdrawn only to be replaced by the head and shoulders of a man. The wind chime rang wildly as he caught it. She came off the bed, bolting for the door, but in two strides he had caught her by the hair and thrown her into the dresser. She yelped as the beveled edge slammed into her side. Grimly she grasped a silver-backed hairbrush and gave the intruder a ringing blow between the eyes as he moved in on her. He bellowed, and as if in answer, a second man entered through the window. This one carried a gun. Being naked and armed only with a hairbrush, she decided to opt for prudence. With a little shrug, she dropped her inadequate weapon and raised her eyebrows inquiringly. "Get in the other room," the second man ordered, while her assailant gingerly rubbed his head and then inspected the damage in the mirror. "May I put on some clothes?" "Get her something." The man abandoned the mirror, but continued rubbing as he stepped into the closet and then emerged with one of Tachyon's coats. It was too small, and she felt the shoulder seam split as she forced it on. Both the men were Orientals, Chinese, she guessed from the high planes of their faces and their size. Of the four men who stood threateningly over Tachyon in the front room, two were Chinese, the other two, jokers. The tall reptilian joker wasn't too bad, but his four-foot-tall companion sent a cold shudder across her bare skin, and the hair on the back of her neck tried to climb for cover. Rillette had a horror of flying, stinging insects, and now she was faced with a human wasp. The body of the creature was vaguely humanoid, but the face was a triangular wedge complete with multifaceted eyes, and between the legs hung a long stinger. Transparent wings beat, a frantic tattoo, filling the room with a low buzz. A nervous little laugh erupted from her. My God, when mysterious East meets homegrown grotesque, does that give us joker slavery? She inquired brightly, and staggered as a hard blow from behind took her between the shoulder blades. Tachyon came off the couch like a compact, red-headed whirlwind, dodged a blow from the left and wriggled out of a second man's grasp. There was a blur of motion, and the wasp jabbed its stinger into the back of Tak's knee. The reptilian joker's lips skinned back in a grimace of pleasure as the Takesian cried in agony and collapsed. "It won't kill you, Tachyon. Just hurts like hell. And he's got unlimited stings, so don't try it again." The tall joker in a show of strength caught Tachyon by the nape of the neck and set him on his feet. The alien touched the inflamed and swollen skin at the back of his knee, eyed the .38 pressed against Roulette's throat, and the fighting tension leached from his body. It was an outlandish picture they presented, four burly Chinese in satin jackets and mirrored sunglasses, some with guns drawn, others with what the sensational press called suspicious bulges under their arms. A joker perched like an obscene bug on the back of the couch, and the reptile leaning nonchalantly against the piano, cleaning his long, sharp nails with a switchblade. Then there was Tachyon, tiny and rumpled, his hair tangling on his shoulders, gown gaping to reveal his pale chest, and the head of his cock peeking like a shy bird between the folds of material. The joker by the piano gestured, and two of his men swung out straight-backed chairs from the dining room table. "Dr. Tachyon, please, sit down. Then we can talk. Tommy?" One of the Chinese glanced up, alert, quivering like a dog on a scent. "Please tie the good doctor." I wouldn't want him trying anything stupid. Then I might have to hurt the lady. Roulette and Tachyon were hustled to the chairs, and he gave her a concerned glance. She smiled with a confidence she didn't feel, and said, "What a blow. Betrayed by popular culture yet again." "I don't understand. In the Fu Manchu books, the Yellow Peril is always mysterious and exotic. Spoils it when the goons have names like Tommy and speak with flat Brooklyn accents." Snake Face's long, forked tongue lolled out, and he eyed her with hostility. "You want exotic? Just keep it up, and I'll let the boss handle you. He'll give you all the exotic you can stomach." Tachyon sat with relaxed elegance, but his lips were white, and Roulette realized that the sting was still paining him. Tommy finished binding him to the chair with the belt of his dressing gown, and tilting back his head, Tachyon drawled, "Of course, I am delighted to have your company, but might I know to what I owe this singular pleasure?" Snake Face pulled out a chair with his foot and straddled the seat, arms folded across the back. Roulette was free, but one of the thugs had placed a hand on her shoulder, and she was very aware of all those guns, and if there was one thing she had learned from her police officer father, it was don't fuck with a gun. "Tacky, we've come for the book." The alien's coppery, upswept brows climbed towards his bangs. "My good man, I have something in excess of 1,000 volumes in this apartment. To which book do you refer?" "Hit him," came the flat reply. Tommy swung. There was a sound like a dull axe biting into wood, and Tachyon spat out a mouthful of blood. Roulette noticed he was careful to aim the sticky glob onto the lap of his gown and thus protect the white carpet. "The book! I'm not a lending library." This time Tommy moved to the front, gathered a fold of the gown in a fist, hauled Tachyon up against his bonds, and gave him several hard backhands. The Chinese was wearing a number of rings, and Roulette bit back a squeak as the metal dug into the alabaster skin. When he finished, the alien's lip had split, his nose was bleeding, and one eye was blackening. "Hiram will no doubt refuse me entrance tonight," he murmured around his rapidly swelling lip. "He does so like a gentleman to be point device." The forked tongue unrolled and flicked caressingly across Tachyon's face, licking up the blood. "Tacky, maybe you don't understand. I'm going to have that book if I have to take you apart to get it." Tachyon dropped the affected, maddening tone and said bluntly, "I truly don't know what you're talking about. What book?" The Joker stared implacably back at him. "It was stolen. I know you have it, and I'm going to get it back." The alien sighed. "Very well. Please search my home, but I assure you I have no stolen book." "Search it. Tear the place apart." Tachyon winced. "But tie her first. We don't want to be distracted." Tommy pulled a thin cord from his pocket and quickly bound her hand and foot to the chair. They scattered and began to ransack the apartment. The wasp continued to sit on the couch, buzzing and chittering to himself. A cascade of books tumbled from an upper shelf, hitting and shattering a delicate celadon bowl as they fell. Pain and anger flickered deep in Tachyon's eyes, but his voice was level, almost conversational, as he said, "Twice in as many months, this is quite beyond everything. I can forgive the swarmling. It was a mindless monster and so destroyed without thought, but these thugs." "I thought you had powers." "Someone told me you did," Roulette said in a low voice. "I do." "Then why didn't you use them?" "I began to. Then I heard you scream, and I realized there were more than four." "I can control 3 humans," he whispered, "but the hold is weak, and if I should also have to fight?" He turned the full force of his beautiful eyes on her. I was afraid you would be hurt if my powers proved less strong, or my reflexes less quick than pride would like me to admit. And that wasp is damnably fast. An aggrieved grumble. So what do we do? Wait and pray for an opportunity. I wish you didn't have shields, he added fretfully. I could keep contact with you telepathically. Oh, well, no good morning for a fled ship. Shh. Yellow really isn't your color, my dear, he said, responding quickly to her warning. One of their captors gave them a suspicious glance as he walked past, and Roulette said pettishly for his benefit, I don't need a commentary on taste from you. You're the one who picked this cat vomit yellow. The Chinese's mouth spread in a wide grin that displayed a good deal of pink gum and a gold-capped tooth, and he passed into the kitchen alcove. Tachyon cast her a rueful glance. Cat vomit? I'd always thought it a particularly lovely shade of lemon. Roulette laughed, and the alien gave her an approving look.